in the evening, because I mean, this is, I've been here for 23 years, and what keeps me coming in is the amazing voices of the Pacifica Radio Archives. It's an amazing collection, nothing like it in the world, and here's a chance for you to take some of this home with you and give it away as gifts, because we guarantee that they get out by the holidays.
Right, we want to share it with you so that you can share it with others, because it's not just a job, it's part of our lives and part of our daily humanity. You know, we carry it with us when we walk the walk, talk the talk, if we can. And certainly we have a lot to live up to with these the visionary thinkers in the Pacifica Radio Archives. 10 more seconds in this fun drive. We really appreciate you, the Pacifica Radio listeners. Please keep calling and contact the archives at pacificaradioarchives.org.
Pacifica Radio Archives' 12th Annual Holiday Fun Drive Broadcast, Preserving a Living History, on all five Pacifica radio stations. 99.5 FM WBAI New York, 89.3 FM WPFW Washington DC, 90.1 FM KPFT Houston, 94.1 FM and 89.3 FM KPFA KPFB Berkeley, 88.1 FM KFCF Fresno, 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles, also heard on 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, 99.5 FM China Lake, 93.7 FM North San Diego.
Hello, yes, this is Brother Cornell West, and I am here to do all that I can to support my dear brothers and sisters at Pacifica. Students, faculty, teachers need to get in on this magnificent project and program. I'm doing all that I can. I'm behind it 120%. It is what we need in these times.
Call 1-800-735-0230. Our volunteers can help you select your gift. You'll receive two copies of your gift, one for you and one for a school.
No, I did not do that. The PRA broadcast cut off on its own. I was going to segue with a cool sound effect like this. It's all relative in time and space. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM live for the first time in 48 hours. Thank you, Pacifica Radio Archives. A lot of the WBAI Pacifica Radio Archives, by the way, are available for free online at archive.org. Even some shows I've produced, even some music I've produced, as a matter of fact, with Peter Schickele and people like that there. This is not, I am not Robert Knight. I am Jim Freund. Robert Knight is a great journalist and a mensch. I told him, listen, next week is the 50th anniversary of the Kennedy assassination. And I know that you are heavily into the politics and into the various different theories and all that. So the stupidest thing you could do would be to donate your airtime for the 50th anniversary that happened the day after, which was the first broadcast of a science fiction TV show called Doctor Who. And he wrote me back and he said, Jim, I've never taken your advice before and I see no reason to do so now. So enjoy having a 3-hour Doctor Who special. So first, major shout-outs to Earthwatch and to Robert Knight, and thank you so much. He's done this for me like three or four times when I did the Tolkien special last year with the Council of Elrond and things like that. And he has yet to ask for reciprocation, which he certainly do if ever Robert wants to do, and certainly deserves to do, a three-hour program, then I will be, you know, turning Hour of the Wolf over to him. When I used to do this with Simon Lokely, and his show was called Once Upon a Time, Why the Revolution Hasn't Come, and I was Hour of the Wolf. We called it Why the Wolf Hasn't Come. We still have to come up with, like, Earth Wolf, or some Hour of the Watch, or something like that. But it's all relative in time and space. I mean, yeah, today is Thursday for almost 3.5 minutes now, but not if you're listening in L.A. Hopefully you're still listening to us in Pacifica. Hopefully you're listening to us over WBAI.org. I know for a fact we have a listener in Bulgaria. I heard a rumor that we had a listener in some far, far flung place. Is that correct? You can say something.
We might have somebody listening in from Manitoba tonight.
Oh, okay.
My father is listening in at Vietnam. Sorry, that's in Vietnam.
That's the one I happen to be thinking of.
Yeah.
You beat me.
Yeah.
Manitoba is just a little bit
Hi,
north.
Daddy. Yeah.
Vietnam is like east, and he gets the luxury of listening. What is it, like mid-morning?
He's 11 hours ahead of us.
So whenever you're listening, you know, it's this wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey kind of a thing of whether it's Wednesday night, Thursday morning, if you're across the international dateline or whatever. But before we begin our... This is hardly, by the way, the first Doctor Who special I've had. I come on the air. I put on airs as I come on the air and say, my radio program is about literary science fiction. Except when it's Doctor Who! I'm a fanboy! Screw you! It's Doctor Who! Yes! That Star Trek stuff like Keith writes. Keith DiCandido, who is with us, has written for a number of franchises.
20, actually. I hit 20 this year when I did a novel based on the TV show Leverage. That was my 20th franchise that I've
But they're really cool shows that you're getting there.
And I've done Doctor Who, for that matter. But,
anything, Gina helped me with her last name.
Bellman.
I am, ever since I saw Coupling. So, yeah. And some poses that she did in the third season. Mm. Anyway. Mm. And I've been a huge Timothy Hutton fan since Nero Wolf.
Yes.
So Leverage is very cool. So you see, yeah, I am a fanboy, but I'm a fanboy of the radio show. So there.
He's not afraid to use it.
That's right.
That's right. With us is Keith DiCandido. Keith R. A. DiCandido is the proper byline.
Crad. It's Cradical.
Or that.
It's Cradical, yeah. Jim Ryan, who was here about a month ago, almost exactly, right?
Yeah, it's about a month.
It was about a month ago, reading a story. I had no idea what it was about, but it was a Whovian mash, a Whovian Beatles mashup.
Well, it was actually more of an alt hiss, in that the idea that...
As opposed to a boo hiss, yeah.
Bit of a boo.
Sorry.
Where the idea was that the parlophone sessions did not go well, and after a certain amount of friction and a court appearance, the Beatles break up, and Ringo finds himself at odds, ultimately falls into acting, and ends up being the constant companion throughout his run for Patrick Troughton.
Right, so he's a second Doctor companion.
Yes, well, according to this, at the time the story was
written... And many people would say that he was a companion of sorts.
true enough.
If you think about it, yep. you know, even more so than Pete Best or.
Well, that's true. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. At the time the story was written, there had not been a companion that was there throughout the entire run of a Doctor. Well, who's going to know?
Yeah. Although I submit that River Song was always there. Because we don't know her adventures, you know. I'm a huge River Song fan. I'm
sure.
Sorry. It comes through often. Mm. And also with us, Carol Pinchevsky.
Hi-ho.
Hi-ho. Carol has been, and over the last couple of years, has been the most professional Whovian of all, because when you think of important business magazines, I don't mean Bloomberg.
Don't say that to my husband.
Oh, is he really?
He works
for Bloomberg.
Not the media.
I don't mean
the
Wall Street. Okay, I don't mean the Wall Street Journal.
Yeah.
Okay, I mean, what other magazine than Forbes would want to cover Doctor Who? Well, it turns out that eventually they didn't, but...
Right. I was the official geek blogger for Forbes.com, though not the magazine. It was Forbes.com.
Who
for
cares
if
it was Forbes?
But before that...
Money comes in the same stomach.
Yeah. But before and after, and in fact during, I also write for the website of the Sci-Fi Channel, Blaster.com.
Ah, okay, cool. That's right, for Craig Engler.
Yes, but I work directly for Scott Edelman. Hi, how's Scott?
Oh, good God.
Yes.
That bum.
That guy.
I have still never... God, he and I have had more trains crossing in the night about having him live on the show, and every time I see him at a convention, he says, no, I want to do the show live.
Oh,
and
you should. Like, you should have him. He's wonderful.
You know, and I wasn't doing phone interviews. I know how wonderful Edelman is.
Yeah.
But, oh, God, that melon. what's the name of it? Begins with a D. The one that that Anthony Bourdain goes crazy for.
Jorian.
Yes, he came to a ReaderCon with Dorian.
Oh, he didn't.
He did with two of them.
Uh-huh.
And he...
You know they're illegal to have in hotels in Malaysia.
Yes, and this was a hotel.
Luckily, ReaderCon is not actually held in Malaysia, so this was less of a problem than it might have been.
No, this was in Burlington, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. Okay. And in the hotel, during the Meet the Pros party, Edelman is walking around with two durians and a machete.
I wish I were there for
and
that.
And he empties the party. I have full video of this.
Wow. Of course.
And the party empties out, you know, 400 science fiction writers and fans all empty out and go to the parking lot. The security people come over seeing this guy with a machete.
This tall person.
Yeah, Scott is freakishly tall.
Uh-huh. And you know, what are you doing? And one of the smart fans says, oh, don't worry, he used to work for Marvel Comics, which really helps a lot, you know. And we were explaining to the Durian, and damn, if the security people weren't like, okay, that smells awful, I've got to taste it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They were great, the security people. They really, really were. But that's Scott Edelman all over. He must do his show.
Well.
He's
also
the only person who's ever done a zombie story that I thought justified somebody writing a zombie story.
No, there are some excellent zombie stories out there.
Well, we can discuss it at some other point. But right now, before we get talking Whovian, which is our main point of discussion, it is Persons' time, not people time, Persons' time. Dan Persons of Ciné Fantastique magazine has... what is generally a weekly review, which he does for us here at Hour of the Wolf and also on Chronic Rift, which Keith works on. And if anybody wants like really horrifying stuff, there are at least two videos somewhere online of me and Keith on Chronic Rift on the TV show.
Yes.
Including a reading, the worst reading I've ever seen, of They're Made Out of Meat.
Okay.
I produced the best reading of it ever.
Oh, really?
Okay, fair enough.
But
I thought it was a pretty good reading.
Yeah, have you watched it lately?
Oh God, no, no. What are you, insane? No, God, John started putting those on. We've been putting old episodes of the Public Access Show on.
John Drew,
yes, has been the producer of the Rift. Has been putting the old episodes of the Public Access Show on basically exactly 20 years after they aired the first time.
Yeah.
Jim and I did a thing where we read Terry
Bisson. A short story by Terry Bisson, yeah.
Yeah, they're made out of meat. And I look at that and I cringe because, yeah, we were in our 20s, man. You know, we were all a lot younger. I didn't have the beard.
You were in our 20s. I was in our 30s.
Well, yeah, but I was talking about those of us who produced it. And
you mean back in the Stone Age?
Yeah, really. You know, we produced it in this tiny little studio in the basement of a welding company on 59th Street, which isn't even there anymore. It's become condos.
And that's because of the Rift.
Quite possibly,
it's not
yes,
there anymore. Oh, clearly. Mm. Anyway.
But Dan actually has been on the Rift since those days, actually. He was our movie reviewer back on the Public Access Show.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah,
okay. I know I've known him for years and years, but a lot of the original reason for that was that he was on Ciné Fantastique magazine.
Yes.
He was one of the editors, and I love Ciné Fantastique. I thought it was a great, great magazine. And it is to be pointed out, by the way, that Ciné Fantastique has a website at this point. I think it's cfq.com.
It's actually Ciné Fantastique.
.com. Well, whatever .com, it is.
And CFQ Online, I think, also directs it.
Okay. They are currently doing a Kickstarter, which ends in about a week for Dan and, I guess, some other principals.
Larry French and Steve Bodrowski.
To do actual, you know, they're currently doing movie reviews and stuff. They want a budget. What a concept. Yeah. To do interviews.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So please go to that Kickstarter. It's time for Dan's review. Let's play it. Let's actually listen to it. Do I have it potted up correctly? Let's hope so. We'll be back shortly. I said we'd be back shortly, and then, of course, it's being queued up just went away. There is, as Paul Wonder used to say, there is never, ever a show of duration more than half an hour that doesn't have at least one technical two up every time. If you don't know what the word two is, there are the seven words you can't say on radio. Take number two. Okay. So it always has a foul up. Okay. So give me a moment, Dan. I know I've got the review. Ah, here we are. Re-cue, restart, wibbly wobble, go. Don't chuckle.
Hour of
Mike.
The Wolf movie review, air date November 21st, 2013. They came back.
Like
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. And it's been a good year for The Walking Dead on TV. We have, of course, the actual Walking Dead TV series, now in its fourth year, while BBC America has just finished up Torchwood Miracle Day, in which the dead don't so much come back as never go away. Now, the Sundance Channel is running an unusual French series, The Returned, in which the dead do indeed rise, not to munch on the terrified living, but just to move back in for reasons so far unknown. That show is actually based on a French film of 2004 called Les Revenants, or The Returned in Europe, known here by the more pulpy but still accurate title, They Came Back. In that film, a worldwide phenomenon causes about 50 million of the relatively recently dead to rise en masse from their graves. They are passive yet restless, able to communicate coherently, and apparently cognizant of their environment and their previous lives, yet with a disturbing detachment that one expert likens to aphasia. The film, directed by Robin Campillo, observes the effect of the phenomenon on one French town, focusing initially on the official response, the establishing of a bureaucracy and a large dormitory to house the returned, the work of counselors as they reunite families, and the introduction of a drug to stave off the corpse's restlessness. Soon enough, the story zeroes in on a few of the people affected. A couple reunited with their young son, a senior whose wife comes back, a woman trying to rebuild the relationship she had with her lover. Even as the broader tale begins to reveal an unsettling pattern to the return's actions. One of the big lures for zombie stories is our eternal uncertainty about whether the people we know and love are really as we perceive them. How much do we impose our own presumptions on them? How much of the real person do we fail to see because of those presumptions? The traditional zombie story capitalizes on that anxiety, amplifying it, forcing us to consider a situation in which we look into the face of the familiar and the loved and realize that it is totally antagonistic to us. They Came Back takes the standard scenario and cools it down, stripping away the mortal peril and steering it closer towards the realm of invasion of the body snatchers. The premise then turns upon the unsettling notion of people coming face to face with those they had feared lost and discovering devastatingly that wishing a person back into your life is not nearly enough to make it so. Campillo takes a quiet, restrained approach to his tale, and the film is full of striking, disturbing imagery. The mass movements of the revived as they wander out of a cemetery and into the town's main street. A nocturnal gathering of the dead as they sit at a conference table, muttering cryptic instructions to each other. There's also not a little sardonic humor in situations where a revived engineer put back to work comes up with plans that sound like an elaborate tomb, or the government trying to decipher the behavior of the returned sets up electronic-equipped weather balloons to track them as if they were some kind of migrating herd. For some viewers, the restraint may be too restrained, the drama desaturated to the point of aimlessness, and it should be noted that more questions are raised than are answered, that the film's single moment of violence feels unmotivated in context, and that the ending will not satisfy those who prefer their stories tied up in a neat bow. Yet for me, Campillo's tone of restrained menace combined with senses of desperation and grief are enough to make They Came Back an indelibly unsettling and emotionally rewarding experience well worth seeking out. It's available on Amazon Instant View now, and the series that it inspired, The Returned, is currently running on the Sundance Channel, and that's worth checking out as well. I'm Dan Persons. Please check out our Kickstarter by searching on the term Cinefantastique or by using the links over at cfqonline.com.
We're having such a good time talking here. I'm sorry, Dan, we didn't hear all that you had to say, but we knew it was good. Again, we remind people to go to the URL that he mentioned and check out his Kickstarter. No prices to be discussed. We are non-commercial and all that, but let's just say they are worthy. Once again, you're tuned, you're tuned to Listener Response. Let me do a proper break. You are tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifico Radio in New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. Okay, so that was an actual bona fide semi-professional break. Yes, thank you. Let me turn on your mic. Okay, now your mic's on.
Sounded very official.
Yeah, well, I used to be chief announcer many, many, many years ago, and I used to do that kind of thing.
There you go.
Okay. And who knows? Anyway, the day after the Kennedy assassination, nobody really paid a whole lot of attention to the fact that a new TV show had appeared on the BBC. And there were reasons not to pay attention to that, including the fact that, well, it was a kids' show, for the most part. And, well, they just didn't it wasn't the kind of thing that people normally went for. They had these very strange musicians that were working on the show. There's an electronic form of music called music concrète, which was a movement coming out of the late 1940s that used ring modulators and various things. And these people created all the sounds, and they came up with a... not a music concrète theme song. They got a fellow to write some music that sort of, well, explained the show. This is the 1967 version. I was just putting to our panel here, okay. You know, for the really hardcore Whovians.
Yeah. Are you gonna test us?
No.
I think we could, the three of us together. Because
that version was definitely Patrick Troughton.
Yeah.
That was 67. Yeah. So that was definitely
the groovy
Troughton.
One. The groovy one. But
lots of things were groovy in 67.
I thought the Baker was still on the outer fringe of grooviness.
Right. Yeah.
At least his logo, that diamond.
Yeah. I loved that logo.
That was so 1974.
Actually, I thought the one from the 80s was just so painfully 80s. McCoy one was just actually really not attractive.
I at that point I felt the show was not attractive.
Such a shame because Sylvester McCoy was wonderful.
He was wonderful. He was wonderful, but the show had time jump the shark.
There were some good episodes.
And I found them in retro, But let's just give a little bit of history of what we're talking about, because this isn't a fan panel. Keith and I and two other folk did. I was on at least two Doctor Who panels during PhilCon.
So was I.
But
one of them wasn't one you were on.
Exactly. So there were at least three, maybe four. Whovian panels there. I was on one that was like, let's put Stephen Moffat on trial. And it's like,
I didn't know that one.
And I became a defendant on that one.
Really?
Yes, really, because I believe that he may not be the best showrunner, and that the episodes he has written while he has been the showrunner were not necessarily the best episodes. But the episodes that he wrote when he was not the showrunner may be the best episodes of the series since its reboot.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree. I've met him twice. He seems like a very, a person who knows what he wants and how he wants it. Mm. And I think maybe he seemed in some ways a logical choice for showrunner because he has such a clear vision, obviously. Obviously to others, but maybe not as obvious to us, the watchers.
Yeah, exactly. You know? The watchers. Yeah. That's something else. Who watches the watchers?
To say he's got a clearer vision than we do, that's a kind way of putting it. He's very obtuse in terms of trying to disguise where things are going to go.
Yeah.
But we're still getting ahead of ourselves.
Yes,
give a précis? I mean, at this point, Doctor Who has jumped the fanish, cultish thing and become a world force. This Saturday, for those people who don't know, marks the 50th broadcast.
50th anniversary.
50th anniversary, thank you.
And it's more so than that, because I was noticing this as I was trying to set the machine, because my wife isn't going to be able to watch it with me because of some heavy-duty mitzvah. The program is not just going to be premiering around the world at the same day, but the same time. So it will be a live broadcast throughout all time zones simultaneously.
And it will also be in a number of theaters in 3D.
But I thought that was on Monday. That was the Monday after.
The theatrical thing is Monday, just because you can't really.
I didn't realize.
But movie theaters aren't going to give up weekend box office.
Stop. Right. Stop, everybody. What's the show? That's what I'm trying to get at. We have people listening who've never heard of Doctor Who.
Doctor Who is
to explain to people listening, because I said this isn't just a panel at a con. Right. People don't know what a con is. People don't know who or what who is. So we really need to explain it.
Doctor Who is a TV show about a person who travels throughout time and space in a device that looks like an old British police box, which is basically a glorified phone booth for cops in England that has long since fallen out of use, but was relatively common in 1963 when the show debuted. But he travels around in time and space and helps people. That's really what it boils down to.
Yes.
He goes to many different times and many different places, and the TARDIS, as it's called, can go anywhere and anywhen.
Time and
relative dimensions in space.
is what the Doctor's alleged granddaughter.
Yes.
What alleged? It's his granddaughter.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, but you see, that just brings in other questions. So there's always
she called him grandfather. As far as I'm concerned, that means he's his granddaughter. Even if they're not biologically related, then who cares?
Yeah. Okay. But William Hartnell, one of the grand old actors of British cinema and Carry On Sergeant and this movie and that movie, was the first Doctor. How old was he approximately when he started in 1963?
He was older, because the reason he stepped down is for health reasons.
Yeah, but I mean,
he wasn't actually that old, at least by current standards, but he was in poor health to begin with.
And he did the show for a number of years.
For 3 years,
and he was, and his health by the third year, and they had no idea the show was going to continue, was truly failing. And so somebody came up with the idea.
It was Verity Lambert, the producer.
Verity Lambert. Mm-hmm. There will be, as a matter of fact, Friday night, it'll be on BBC America, on Friday night, they'll be broadcasting it several times, a show called Adventures in Time and Space.
Yes. Yes.
Which is a dramatization of the story of Verity Lambert and her... she was the first showrunner. There was another person who actually created...
Sidney Newman.
Thank you. Sidney Newman actually created Doctor Who. Verity Lambert was the producer and showrunner of the program, and... fostered the show through, what, like 12 years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And many, many other shows. Shall we say The Avengers? No Hulk need apply. I mean, The Avengers. Yeah. Steed and Peel. That, for me, those are The Avengers.
Definitely.
I don't know who those mighty...
Yeah, the mighty guys actually did technically come first, but...
Did they?
Yes.
Wow.
Okay, now...
The comic debuted in 63.
Oh, okay, and The Avengers debuted
a little later than that.
In 1959.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Oh, it was about the radio show.
Right. No.
Oh, the TV show did come first.
The TV show. Remember, Honor Blackman is the third
companion. Oh, no, I knew that.
And she starts in about 62.
Okay.
Diana Rigg comes in 63, and that's the first we see.
I said corrected. By the way,
so it's a show from the 1950s.
Okay, then it didn't come first. However, by the way, William Hartnell was actually only 55 when the
he was that
the show
young. Was,
yes, yeah.
Wow.
But,
because he looks
and
elderly.
He died
older.
He died 12 years later. He died in 75.
Yeah, mm-hmm. He was
and if you see him in 1973
in the three doctors.
You can tell he's not in the best of shape, and he was 65 at that point.
So they're doing a documentary about the creation of Doctor Who, 2 hours long, called Adventures in Time and Space, with David Bradley, brilliant choice, playing William Hartnell.
Right.
For those of you who don't know who David Bradley is, think Fitch.
Think in Harry Potter. Oh, crap,
yes, Fitch.
Oh, Fitch in Harry Potter. No, but he's also in so many other things.
He's in many things.
He's in Game of Thrones as Walder Frey.
I don't watch Game of Thrones.
Oh, well, then
just because it's written by a guy that I'm friends with, I don't watch gory things.
That's pretty gory.
It's pretty gory.
And he tends to play very mean people. I was going to use a curse word, but it's great to see him play a good guy.
He was a very gentle guy in, what was that show with David Tennant and...
Broadchurch?
Broadchurch,
yes. Oh, we'll see.
Brilliant, brilliant show. Yes. But we can't say too much about the performance he gives without spoilers.
True, true.
Because you don't quite know his nature, which is the nature of many mystery shows. They're making an American version of
with David Tennant, no
with,
less.
Well,
really?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hopefully his accent will be better than it was for Rex is Not Your Lawyer.
But I thought that the woman in Broadchurch, I thought she was amazing. Mm. I thought Tennant was, you expect nothing but greatness from Tennant, but mm-hmm. this woman was just, she made... the show even more special. They should give out even better than David Tennant awards. That, you know, she stole the show.
Actually, I preferred him in Spies of Warsaw more so than Broadchurch.
David Tennant, we should add, is one of the many actors who has played the Doctor, which is
okay.
what we're talking
about. So going back, with William Hartnell's health being what it was, thank you for putting me back on track, Wibbly Wobbly Jim.
Yes.
They came up, Verity Lambert came up with the idea, well, he's alien, let him regenerate. When it comes time for the Doctor to die, he'll regenerate. And so he regenerated into an actor named Patrick Troughton,
yes.
who's a wonderful actor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can see all of these episodes. Yeah.
Not all.
The BBC had a nasty habit of recording over their videotapes. There were, however, kinescopes sent to other countries. And this was actually the panel that I did with Keith at Philcon about the alleged 150-something episodes, of which 9 have been released. How many are really viewable? Nobody really knows, and the BBC ain't going to say until they have soaked every last shilling out of the franchise, out of these. But I suspect there's probably, maybe 40 or so, Keith?
That something would be like my, that, yeah.
Yeah, we can start a pool.
Yeah.
It could be, and yeah, we don't know what quality, what shape they're in. I mean, we don't know anything, really, because they've been very tight-lipped about the whole thing.
Yeah. So if you are a Netflix subscriber or Amazon.com Prime or one of those streaming services, you can...
iTunes also.
Yeah. You can... yes, but without paying extra money, you can see approximately 30 or 40 classic pre-reboot episodes. If you do it on iTunes, I think they're like 99 cents or $1.99.
Yeah, but you get to keep it on your computer.
Yeah, but on the other services, you get to watch it anytime whatsoever on any.
Assuming
device.
Your Wi-Fi network is working properly and Netflix isn't having buffering issues or any number of other things.
Chromecast is my answer to that. I use a Roku box, but I also have Chromecast and.
Okay.
All that. But all that aside, the point is, if you want a crash course, you can simply go and watch those old ones. The show came to the United States, 74?
About that, yes.
Yeah, about there. With a guy with a very, very, very long scarf.
Mm-hmm.
And that is my doctor. And there is, oh, you can always say, I think for most people this may be true, the best doctor is your first doctor.
But then you're skipping over 3, which was John Pertwee. And then came the guy with the scarf.
Tom Baker.
Yeah, okay. Well,
right.
I was talking about when it came to the U.S.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
Tom Pertwee gave the show... a bit of the James Bond. It got more mod.
Uh-huh.
Although Patrick Troughton was pretty out there.
True.
What was interesting, especially, and this is actually true of the second, third, and fourth people to play the Doctor, is that all three of them came to the show playing against their type. Patrick Troughton was known as a very serious actor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he played... his Doctor is usually referred to as the Cosmic Hobo. You know, he played it very broad, which was much different from what he was known for at the time. By contrast, John Pertwee, who played the Third Doctor, was known as a comic actor, and he actually played the Doctor very straight.
Yeah.
He was
John Pertwee for about 5 seconds, and a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
Yes.
And he's wonderful in it.
Yes.
He almost had the second lead in that movie. Mm-hmm. They were threatening Phil Silvers by having Pertwee take over the role. That's another story. Yes.
And then Tom Baker was known, one of his most famous roles up to that point was playing Rasputin.
Yes.
He was known for playing, you know, nasty bad guys, and he comes on playing basically
this over the top booming voice.
Yeah.
And, wonderful.
And he comes in playing, you know, the love child of Harpo Marx and Toulouse Lautrec.
Yeah. broad
much
grin.
Yeah.
Definitely verging on hippie type. Yeah. Now, we should mention along all these times, we're not going to mention every one, but the Doctor doesn't travel alone.
No.
Not for very long, anyway.
Yeah. Right. He has what I have heard other people call, and I reject this term, assistants. But I've heard that some Brits do that one, Keith.
Yeah.
They're companions.
Yeah.
Yes.
My favorite of which was, always shall be, always will be, no matter who comes along, Sarah Jane Smith.
Yes, yay.
Record holder for the most Doctors.
Yeah. Yes, at this point, yeah.
And River Song comes second, but I disqualify her because she's the Doctor's wife. And I don't want to hear...
Can't be any more companionable than that.
I don't want to hear nothing about the TARDIS being his wife, Mr. Gaiman. His twin sister, maybe. Something other. The wife thing just didn't work for me. But, again, wibbly-wobbly.
Yes.
After Baker, at the end of the Baker season, the series.
He was the longest tenured of the Doctors. He lasted 7 years.
He did 7 years. In either the fifth or the sixth year, they got a new showrunner.
Yes.
John Nathan Turner.
No.
Douglas Adams.
Thank you.
Oh, you're right. I stand corrected.
They got a new showrunner.
That was actually his fourth or fifth year. But, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But late into the Tom Baker run. And Adams didn't have his eye on Doctor Who anywhere near as much as he did the access to the aforementioned BBC Radiophonic Workshop. Because if he could work his day job with Doctor Who, then he could stay after hours and produce his own little radio thing.
Share and enjoy indeed.
So, thus Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which I know everybody in this room, but few people listening are probably aware, was radio for years before it was a book, TV show, theater, or not as bad movie as it could have been.
True.
although it would have been a worse movie if Douglas had actually made it. I had the pleasure, our station manager here was Larry Josephson in the late 70s, and somebody calls him up and says, we got a guy from the BBC, you guys have BBC turntables, right? BBC uses special transcription discs. Their broadcasts came over 14-inch LPs. That no ordinary turntable could play.
Yeah.
These were proprietary things for just BBC. We had one, as did WRVR, another listener-sponsored radio station being run out of the Riverside Church. We had it because we were the appropriate BBC outlet in New York. We played The Goon Show. We played... We were the outlet for many BBC programs until NPR and PBS were created and the BBC discovered that in America, they could make money. And that was just about that time. So this guy who had been working on Doctor Who says, calls up and he says, I've been running a science fiction TV show and radio series in England. I'd like to come to your radio station and talk about it. And Larry Josephson goes, oh, it's a sci-fi guy. I said, it's Freund. So
he'll eat anything.
Yeah, right. So I come and I do an interview with Douglas Adams. And he accidentally left 6 BBC transcription discs behind.
Whoops.
What a butterfinger. He did the same thing about a week later in Los Angeles at our sister station, where this fellow Mike Hodel, who had been on Hour of the Wolf with Margot Adler in 1972, when he was her occasional Monday co-host and I was her regular Thursday and Friday co-host. You know, what a butterfingers. He just kept accidentally leaving these discs.
Accident. Yes. Right.
And by total coincidence, at radio, non-commercial radio stations that had BBC transcription turntables.
What are the odds?
You know,
yeah.
This story could not be told if Douglas had not died prematurely, horribly. Just, you know, yes. He was, what, about 49?
Yeah.
About 49 or
too
something.
Freaking young, anyway.
He was in California working at the time, being very, very upset with Apple because he had designed any number of great computer games and discovered that Apple, and he was this huge Apple devotee,
yes.
would not give him the API, the software things, so that he could convert this game that he wrote with Terry Jones, Starship Titanic.
Oh, yes.
Which I loved.
Yes.
Which
great game.
Yeah, a decent game. You couldn't do it without cheating.
Name a game you can't.
And I think it's very appropriate for
Zork.
A game. Yeah. I think it's very appropriate for a game written by Douglas Adams and Terry Jones to only be able to be won by cheating.
Exactly. Although bureaucracy was harder.
Yeah.
Yes, that's true.
His info one of his right. two info. He did 3 Infocom games.
But
at any rate,
when Douglas Adams was on Doctor Who, he co-wrote one what I consider to be in many ways the quintessential Doctor Who story, which was City of Death.
Ah.
Which was
the Pirate Planet was first, or
Pirate Planet came first because that was the first Romana.
Yeah.
That was part of the Key to the Time.
Okay.
Storyline.
That was the first Romana.
Yes.
Yes.
Because there were 2 Romanas.
Yes.
Because Tom Baker wanted to get married.
Well, yeah, and also Mary Tam only wanted to do 1 season. But
yes.
But the City of Death, it takes place in Paris, and I always have that always has a warm place in my heart because I first saw it not as a teenager, not long after I had been to Paris for the first time. So I'm sitting there playing Spot the Location as I'm watching it. I was there! Hey,
and
I was
that's
there
all
too.
There is, because I just rewatched it recently. And in the 4 episodes, they waste about 40 minutes running up and
they
down
spent,
the
They had a lot of money to spend on Paris locations, and by gum, they were going to use them. But it was still.
Right.
But what was great about it was it's such a wonderful Doctor Who story.
Julian Glover
plays the bad guy.
Star. Yeah,
and there are these 2 weird museum people.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Just okay. just when you think it couldn't get any more awesome, John Cleese
and
Eleanor Braun. Yeah.
Thank you.
Show
thank
up.
You. Well, of course, Beatles fandom would know Eleanor Braun.
Yes.
I will say no more.
Yes.
As I used to put it, go to the window.
And it also plays on the old story of the theft of the Mona Lisa and the rumor that there were 6 forgeries of the Mona Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
And they put a nice little time travel spin on it by having Leonardo da Vinci actually have painted 6 other Mona Lisas.
Mm-hmm.
But it's
yeah,
it's
none
wonderfully
of them are forgeries. It's a great idea.
Yeah, and it has one of my all-time favorite lines from the Doctor, which is when he's talking to the femme fatale that inevitably is in such a caper story, and he just looks at her and says, "Well, you're a beautiful woman, probably."
Yeah,
I love that line sums up the Doctor perfectly.
But this is the imprimatur that Douglas Adams put on it. And, you know, after Verity Lambert, I think she was really the first strong thing. Then there was the fellow who created the Daleks and...
Terry Nation.
Was he ever a showrunner?
He was never actually a showrunner.
No. He was just a writer.
Yeah. Terrence Dix worked on the show for a while. Robert Holmes.
Oh, right.
Yeah, Robert Holmes was funny. Very good.
Yeah.
He was very good. And then after Tom Baker leaves, we go to the first time ever a known actor, somebody who had had their own TV series before, mm-hmm. had a track record, and oh my God, was under 40-something years old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Peter Davison.
Who was also playing against type if you compare his character in All Creatures Great and Small with the Doctor.
Well, no, he played someone kind in All Creatures Great and Small.
He played the guy who would rather go out drinking with his pals at the...
But he liked animals.
So that made him okay.
The Peter Davison Doctor, you know, at first I just sort of like cast him off, which I shouldn't have done, because he wore a celery stick for yeah. a lapel.
That's what was that's what
piece.
Made him awesome.
I know that now, Keith. I know that now. In rewatching recently that span of stuff that's available on streaming media, I began to really appreciate how great Peter Davison really was.
Actually, I loved those episodes because they were just so tight. I thought they were just very well written and very well edited.
And a lot of those are between Douglas Adams and Robert Holmes.
Right. Yeah. I thought he had a very fortunate set of circumstances surrounding his tenure as the Doctor.
Who, Davison?
Yeah.
Well, no, but Holmes did a couple episodes, but Adams had moved on at that point. Right. He wasn't involved with Davison at all. All the episodes
I thought there was a little bit of a crossover.
No, John Nathan Turner took over as showrunner in Tom Baker's last two seasons. That was when
two
he switched.
No,
it's two seasons. There was...
Then we have a problem when Douglas Adams was the showrunner.
The episode.
The six and seven. I'm pretty sure it was, at the very least, Nathan Turner was there for his last season. I think it was his last two. Because that was when he switched from the multicolored scarf to the maroon scarf.
Okay.
And that was Nathan Turner.
Well, I'll generally trust Keith on this stuff.
And,
that was a great fashion decision, actually.
I didn't think so. I loved that. The multicolored scarf was iconic. The maroon scarf was just sort of a scarf. It was just a scarf with a pituitary problem, you know. But
after Peter Davison, we move on to Colin Baker, and the show gets darker, much, much darker. This is not Colin Baker's fault.
No.
Which is funny, because everyone who's ever met him has told me that he's just this nice, affable guy.
He was actually very good-natured about it. I said, so did you have any regrets about the whole period? And he jokingly said, next!
And, you know, you're at the mercy of your writers.
Yes.
And that's all there is to it.
He actually was playing the same type of character he had played, though. He had made a name for himself playing bombastic, blowhard type person. Probably one of my favorites of his was playing Babin the Executioner in Blake 7.
And I just saw an interview with him yesterday. I don't know how old it is, but I saw the interview yesterday in which they were saying, what did you want for a costume? And he said, basic black. I wanted what Chris Eccleston ended up with. This kind of a guy should be able to blend in almost anywhere.
And instead he got the exact opposite.
His doctor was a patchwork multicolored mess.
Yes. Doctor Who and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat.
Yeah.
But garish. Yeah. Really garish.
Mm-hmm. On the other hand, if you ever went clothes shopping in the 80s, you didn't have a lot of choice back then.
True.
He did get to keep the question marks.
It's the only time in which in the 80s in which the clothing outdid the hair. And by this time I'm lost. I'm not watching. I tune in maybe once a month, just to stay with it. And you know, it wasn't that I disliked... Well, I did dislike the Doctor, but it wasn't the actor's fault.
No.
And then Sylvester McCoy comes in.
Mm.
And I thought, oh my God, wordplay. The Doctor is... He did puns. He was a terrible or wonderful punster, whichever one you think is better. I think being a terrible punster is a good thing.
Yes.
Mm.
To me, a lot of it was recovered until I saw the quality of the scripts and Trials of a Time Lord.
Mm-hmm.
The Trials of the Time Lord was Colin Baker.
Oh, that's Colin Baker.
Right.
But
right.
yeah, so thank God I missed that. But yeah. Yeah. but the final...
Trial of the Time Lord was actually a really good idea that was done in by a couple of factors, not the least of which was Robert Holmes dying before he could finish writing the story.
Yeah. yeah. Wow.
Yes. Which
oh, that's and, what happened. I yeah. never
it's,
knew
it's
that.
A, yeah. It's a very
that's why the ending kind of completely falls apart. The yeah. guy who was supposed to finish it died.
Mm-hmm. It's a very rude thing that people sometimes do.
Yeah, and I wish they would stop it.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the good thing about Sylvester McCoy is that we're finally seeing just how good he is on screen again now that he's Radagast the Brown.
Yes.
Yeah, so...
Yes, except he doesn't belong in that movie.
But...
Radagast belonged in Lord of the Rings. He does not belong in The Hobbit, Mr. Jackson.
It is still nice to see Sylvester McCoy getting out there.
Yeah, and there was... I saw a listener of mine actually was in New Zealand... And he sent me a Lord of the Rings stamp, and it had Sylvester McCoy on it. And I thought, okay, this is cool. I'm getting both Tolkien and who in one nifty postcard.
Yes.
Although if they ever take him up on his offer, Peter Jackson did say he'd go below scale to direct an episode.
Ooh.
That would be fun to
see. I would watch the hell out of that.
There are so many people that have offered. Stephen Fry was supposed to write an episode that was supposed to feature his former acting buddy.
Yeah.
Whatever happened to Laurie.
Hugh Laurie?
Yeah. Hugh Laurie. That was, yeah.
Wow. Well, right now he's touring the world playing blues music, but
yeah, except that
jazz.
He's got
jazz.
He's got he plays.
It's there's a lot of blues in that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there's.
I've got the CD's currently in my car.
Oh, right.
He's good.
Yeah.
At any rate, it's the Thatcher era.
Mm.
There's a woman named Mary Whitehouse. What a name. and she was sort of the Pat Robertson of her day.
My husband is English, and he tells stories about Mary Whitehouse.
Does he?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I told him he should.
I assume she's the villain of the piece.
Yes. Well, she's the...
Ha-ha, Sherrard, you are.
she's very moral majority.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah it and...
Which
and,
is generally neither, but... Yeah.
Yeah.
And the BBC is a government... owned and operated outfit sooner or later, and the show wasn't that great anymore. So that was it. The show was canceled forever, period, until
1996.
Five.
No, it was 96.
Six?
Yeah.
96?
Yeah.
Maybe filmed in 95.
It was, yeah, probably.
Okay, yeah. Because I remember reading.
Yeah, because it was.
Because I remember Paul McGann writing about how he started
April.
In 1995.
That's the spring.
Yeah.
Yeah. So McGann was working in 95.
Yeah.
So
Paul
we
McGann.
Saw it in 90 yeah. cents. And, yeah. And Paul McGann was hired as the eighth doctor. They didn't. They showed us the
regeneration.
Pilots. Regeneration.
The regeneration.
Yeah, Sylvester McCoy appeared in the first
Sylvester
hour.
Sylvester McCoy, who they really didn't do quite justice to his regeneration,
no.
I thought.
Yes and no. Honestly, given the way the Doctor tends to sort of blithely show up at places, it was inevitable that one of the times he just sort of walked out the door, he was going to get shot.
Yeah, but it was sad. It was
well, it was very sad, but it was...
It was also the 90s, too.
Huh?
I mean, in the 90s, you had that. It was expected of things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean...
People who stupidly walk out of doors and get shot?
Well,
and
yeah.
And then he regenerates in a San Francisco hospital into Paul McGann...
Which looks remarkably like Vancouver.
Good actor.
Yes.
And he was an excellent, excellent choice for the Doctor.
Yes.
But they needed a good choice for a writer, for somebody to play the master, for the two companions, not so much Grace, but the
other guy.
Young Asian lad, the gangland kid, who was to become the companion of the series. Oh, by the way, somewhere in there, I recall, Steven Spielberg had bought the rights. He owned the rights to Doctor Who.
Wow.
Right.
And
which is why Amblin has a title card at the end of the film.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah,
that's right. But he decided to make some, you know, meaningless thing like, you know, Schindler's List or something like that instead. And you know, it was an either-or kind of thing, and so he let the rights go to whoever made that really, really... I've tried to rewatch it during the reboot era that they were having on BBC America, and I couldn't...
There are parts of it that are really good.
There are.
And also, honestly, that movie has... The interior of the TARDIS has changed a lot over the years. The basic design has always been the same, but the details of the design has changed tremendously. In Hartnell's era, when it first started, it was a very crowded sort of living room kind of thing with a console in the middle with lots of little extra stuff around. It got more and more pared down as time went on. Until, you know, and then in the Davison era, they started putting, like, little computer keyboards and monitors in the thing with really cheesy 80s graphics. I love watching that. And but it looked really high-tech at the time.
We have to mention, and up until the movie, the TV series had the budget of, well, the current WBAI.
I don't think it was that high.
In one of my favorite episodes, The Ark in Space.
Oh, God, the Vervoids.
Which I'm watching right now on Netflix.
Yeah, okay. I mean, there is this thing in bubble wrap with green spray paint over it. You know, the K-9, the robotic dog, you can see the string as he gets pulled along. And a few times you can actually see the hands of John Leeson, who's doing the voice, who actually crawled along behind the dog during the show. He actually did that.
But in the 96 film, it had the interior of the TARDIS control room, which was actually steampunk before anybody knew what steampunk was.
Very much so.
Gorgeous. Mm-hmm. I love that control room. And the one thing, and you know, we're about to get to the show's revival in 2005. The one thing I've always hated about the 21st century iteration of Doctor Who is I have yet to like a single control room that they have had for the TARDIS on the new show.
I mean,
and especially because we got the platonic ideal of it in 96.
Has anybody else noticed this? The most recent control room, I look at that and I think Qualcomm Stadium. Seriously, if you ever gone to a San Diego
Qualcomm is a British company.
No, yeah, if you ever go to a San Diego Chargers game
or a Padres baseball game,
that's true too. But they have a round area.
They have more of those, if nothing else.
Right, they have a round area with square flags.
Right.
And and each flag has a circle there that represents the different NFL teams, which looks very similar to the detail.
Yeah. Wow. Well, we're in Lewisohn Stadium right now. Right. We really are.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We really are.
Goodness. Yeah, but I mean...
this used to be a stadium where we are right
that
now.
That explains the design of the building.
Right.
Well, the way Janet Coleman of BAI put it is, you take Lewisohn Stadium and you turn it upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's we're in the North Academic Campus of CUNY up here in Harlem, and this was Lewisohn Stadium. Mm. By the way, let me caution folk: when you put your arms down or something like that, you're making a huge crashing noise with springs because they're attached to those mics.
Oops!
There you go. There you go.
Okay.
Yeah. I told this once to Daniel Jose Older, who's a fine musician, and he just used it for percussion. It's great.
I'm still used to the old studios where I could actually put my hands wherever I wanted. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you had a cough button.
I did.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
I missed the cough button. The cough button was awesome.
The cough button is a button which you press, and it automatically mutes your mic for just long enough to hawk or cough. Goodness. Or
now we have to actually cover our mouths. Oh, it's goodness. Really unfortunate.
Well, you signal me, and I turn I turn up your microphone.
I actually like the current interior of the TARDIS. I think it's interesting, and it's different without being over the top spacey.
I think it looks like a play school.
A lot of people dislike it. It doesn't bother me.
I'll tell you what I dislike about it. Not what's in it, but how they use it.
Oh.
They don't use the controls. They just run around. You know, bzz, 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 bzz.
Well, they always did that.
Right.
Well,
no,
yes, but I mean,
no, they did not.
But the way the stadium, the way this looks now, I mean, you see all the running around in the back of your voice you're hearing, and Rivers has dropped it at the 12-yard line, and it's 3-and-out for the Chargers.
Goodness.
No, in fact, they were pointing out in one of the specials I saw that was called, in fact, Adventures in the TARDIS, that they had labels for what the different controls did.
Right, yes.
And that people had to be trained on how to use the TARDIS. So
and in fact, one episode, they had the writing, the handwriting. It was still left on the set accidentally in one episode.
It's like our console here, where we actually do have.
Right, yes. And that was...
Because you can't label things. It's allowed.
That was the episode. It was... I wish I'd remembered the name. It was written in a hurry. It was the First Doctor. It was like episode 3 or 4, and it was a Ship in the Bottle episode.
Yeah. The Land of Giants or something like that?
I don't
Planet
recall.
Of Giants. Planet of Giants.
But it was interesting because the cards were still there. If you look, you can see them theoretically.
Thanks to the joys of high-definition television.
Yeah.
But this was the budget of the show.
Yeah.
For that matter, they tried in the 80s to have a... They created a robot character called Chameleon who could disguise himself as anything.
Right.
And he only really lasted for 2 stories. And the 2 stories were not contiguous, which was even more hilarious.
Yeah.
It's like he agreed to stay on the TARDIS, and then we didn't see him again for half a year.
Right.
Because they couldn't make the robot iteration of the character work.
Yeah, I thought it looked great, actually.
Yeah, it did, but it was
compared
it was
to
way
everything else in Doctor Who.
The show
allowed you to use your imagination.
We're a third of the way into the show, and we haven't even gotten to the half point of the history of Doctor Who.
Nonsense. We've gotten past 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, we've gotten to the BC era, and now it's time for the AD era. Well, 2005.
Well, there is the interregnum. Suffice it to say that the movie was hopefully going to launch an American-based series.
Which it didn't.
Which it didn't. And the bad news is it didn't launch a series. The good news is it didn't launch a series because it would have been American. Mm. And it just would not have had... You know, as it continued through time,
it
would not have had what it gained. So along comes fanfic.
And
actually, I was going to point out that I was even before that, Virgin, before the 96 film, you had Virgin, which was doing New Adventures and Missing Adventures.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The books. New Adventures were all with the Seventh Doctor and continuing the Seventh Doctor story past his final episode. They actually kept with Ace for a while, and then they brought in a few new companions.
But the fanfic I'm thinking of is Radio.
Yes.
Also, yes.
Mm-hmm. Which had a big finish.
Big finish, right.
Yeah, which was not, I believe, was not a truly licensed... I heard some of the licensed material with Tom Baker, and it was bloody awful. Mm. They were like bad audiobooks.
Mm. No, I've heard wonderful Big Finish productions.
Later.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Later. Their current stuff is fabulous.
Yeah.
And the stuff that they... But the early audio stuff, when especially the stuff that was available in the United States here, the legitimate BBC stuff with Tom Baker, sucked.
Wow.
And I have them.
Wow.
Okay, I do have them. In fact, I have a complete Big Finish collection as well.
Wow.
And I am a connoisseur, if I may say so. Mm. Not as much as Max Schmid, but... I know a bit about radio drama. Yeah. Okay,
really?
Just
go figure.
Abyssal. And but the point is that licensed or not, and there was a point where they did become. I think they started Fanish and became licensed.
There were also the BBC at that point didn't give a damn, so they were just basically letting people do whatever they
wanted. For a while, they didn't give a damn. Especially, let me tell you, we heard here at WBAI, we heard a lot from the BBC.
Yeah.
They were giving a damn.
Yeah. But from the late 80s and early 90s, they also, Virgin Publishing, as I said, had the license to do novels. And they did novels and some short story collections until 96, as it happens. Which at which point, after the Fox movie came out, BBC Books took over, and they still have the license. And they started doing Eighth Doctor Adventures.
And bless doing the Eighth Doctor Adventures, because Paul McGann got a bad deal.
Yeah.
He was a fine, fine, fine doctor, and they didn't give him a proper episode until last week.
Yeah.
Right.
Which brings up an interesting point. You talked about being such a fan of the radio drama. And
well, I wasn't going to because I'm not okay, but I never said I'm a big fan of the radio drama.
Okay,
I said they've done some good of radio drama in general.
Okay.
I'm a connoisseur of radio drama in general.
But the fact that elements from Big Finish Productions does actually get a shout out.
More than a shout out. And I was going to get to this.
Yeah.
They destroyed the timelines.
Okay.
They were, nobody thought Doctor Who was ever going to come back.
Right, right.
And so they were not doing what we all know, we will, at least two out of three people in this room besides me will know what I mean, following what I call the Ordover rule. Okay. And no, Carol, it does not mean you have to get naked.
Thank goodness.
That's the other Ordover rule. The Ordover rule that he once described to me on the air that I thought was perfect is when he assigns a writer like Keith DeCandido, Greg Cox, name some...
Peter David.
All these fine writers to... especially when he was in charge of the Star Trek books.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Pocketbooks.
Pocketbooks, which in turn at some point was owned by Paramount. And
they're still affiliated in some way or other.
Eat
yeah.
Little Fish and all yeah. that. Ordover had, I thought, a great, great description. You may borrow my car. You can take it wherever you like. You can drive this car to the bottom of the ocean. You can fly it past Pluto if you can figure out how to make the car fly. You can you start out with four people in the car, or however many, and do anything. But when you return that car, it's going to be in the same damn condition as when it left. That's what I call the Ordover rule. Is that fair, Keith?
Yeah. Yeah. And generally, tie-in fiction works that way. The exception is when you've got something like Doctor Who was between 1986 and 2005.
My point exactly.
1989, rather, in 2005. Mm-hmm. And even with the brief break in 96 for
because
for
they
the movie,
had no idea that that car was ever going to be seen again.
Exactly.
True.
And so both the people producing Big Finish Audios and the people writing the New Eighth Doctor adventures didn't have a reset button.
And exactly. And they were coming up with really good ideas that mm-hmm. were out of canon. That people who were now watching thinking about rebooting the TV series, it's like all of a sudden, okay, it's coming back, it's got a big budget, and what the hell are the Time Wars?
Actually, that was Big Audio, right? Big Finish.
Yes.
That wasn't the books.
Yes, that's what I have been
right.
talking about.
I've been
talking all the time. I've been talking about Big Finish.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That
I keep throwing the books in there because that's what I do.
Yes, exactly. And that's very legitimate, but the books weren't fanfic.
Right.
And well, no, the original Big Finish were.
Originally, but they became official in pretty short order.
I said that. I said that.
And Big Finish also did some short story anthologies, too.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
They became very, very, very legitimate. Yeah. And they became very, very, very good.
And in fact, the first acting David Tennant
They were better than
did.
The BBC at that point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first Doctor Who acting David Tennant ever did was for Big Finish. He did. He played a character in one of Big Finish's Doctor Who audios. Mm-hmm. Not the Doctor, but another character.
Yeah, but at any rate, the point is that they destroyed Gallifrey. They destroyed the Daleks and they destroyed Gallifrey.
Yeah.
And it's a little bit... Now, problem is people's age. I talked about how your favorite doctor is like, you know, the first one you saw and grew up with. Russell Davies grew up with the Big Finish.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Okay. I call him Davies. They always say Davis. So it's, I guess it's Russell Davis. Have you ever worked with him, Carol?
No, I never worked with him. I met him
interviewing somebody who's working with him.
Oh, right.
Yeah,
all right.
Says the guy who interviews people for a living.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, you have worked with Stephen Moffat. You're working on your resume. Get this right. You've worked with, you have worked with Stephen Moffat.
No, I never quoted him. I wound up interviewing I forgot her name. The producer up until recently.
And Sue Virtue.
No.
Oh.
Sue Virtue is Sherlock and Coupling.
I can't remember.
And Mrs. Moffat.
Yeah, I know. But you know, she was also a producer.
No, there's another woman who worked with Russell.
Right.
In the Russell Davies era was his producer.
Right.
I thought it starts with a J.
She was lovely. Yeah.
Anyway.
At any rate, And this, by the way, has been, in fact, when you were several times over the air, and I'm sticking to this, but we should save this for later, predictions of what Saturday's show will be about. And I'm sticking with the prediction that I made 5 months ago as to what the plot line is for Saturday's episode.
Yeah.
And that little, that one, thank God they gave Paul McGann that mini episode.
Well, speaking of Big Finish, one of the things the Big Finish audios have really enabled people to do is rehabilitate and expand the roles specifically of Colin Baker and Paul McGann.
Yeah. Because
both of them got short shrift by their TV appearances. And in Colin Baker's case, he really only did
and
two seasons.
And they've each proven just how wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's amazing how much easier it is to listen to Colin Baker when you don't have to watch him wearing that outfit.
But Paul McGann's outfit, everything about McGann, he was a great doctor.
Yes.
He just never had the chance on camera.
Yeah.
Which brings us back to the point that the fact that stuff that happened in Big Finish audio gets name checked in Night of the Doctor, so that brings up the C word again, of course, canonicity.
Exactly. The thing is
and
that
Night of the Doctor is the webisode that came out last week.
Yes. It's basically a prequel.
You go to YouTube, you look up the Night of the Doctor, you'll see Paul McGann as his doctor would look today, and you learn a little something.
Yeah.
That will hurt you. I mean, that will.
I loved it. I thought it was wonderful.
I thought it was great. I thought it was great.
It had another quintessential Doctor Who line, which is when he says, "Where are we going? The back of the ship. Why? Because the front of the ship crashes first. Think it through."
For some reason, a line that just has stuck with me over the years is Tom Baker saying, "That's odd. That's very odd. Wouldn't you say that's very odd?" But the way he said it,
yeah.
His line readings were half of his. His charm.
Yeah.
So this fellow, Russell Davis, who's a really good writer, who had been doing some other BBC stuff.
Queer as Folk.
Queer as Folk was the British version. A little bit later, he did Casanova
with David
Tennant and Peter O'Toole playing the same person, and then The Second Coming, starring a two-part series starring Chris Eccleston, which is, to use the British word, brilliant. I really, really, really liked it. And you're looking blank.
No, I've never seen this one.
You'll have it. One day you're going to have to get over your Brooklyn thing, come over and watch it. I'm ready for a rewatch, and I have a whole bunch of friends who are. So we'll have people over and do a rewatch of that. Barbara didn't like it so much, but I did. Anyway, it was a little too Gentile for her, I think. And the title, The Second Coming.
Oh, right.
Yeah, well.
Good
fault. To quote River Song, spoilers. But anyway.
It's in the damn title.
Yeah, it is. It's not only in the damn title, it's in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
But anyway, Russell Davis manages to get the Beeb to renew the series on a major budget, using Christopher Eccleston, who is an acknowledged, quirky, but high-quality actor.
And who currently can be seen in theaters as the bad guy in the new Thor movie.
Although, seen but not recognized.
I had no trouble recognizing
him. I haven't seen him.
Okay, no, trust me. No amount of dark elf makeup can hide that face.
No, not
or
not
that voice.
No, it's the voice, yeah.
And what's interesting about the movie is actually, most of his appearances in the movie, he's speaking whatever dark elvish language they made up for the film. And he's much more menacing when he does that than when he speaks English. It's kind of weird.
And
I didn't recognize him at all. I thought he was wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
The current phenomenon of Doctor Who now being a worldwide cult thing is due to that rebooted season that Russell Davis created with Christopher Eccleston as the Doctor, with Stephen Moffat writing two of the best episodes, The Empty Child and The Doctor Dances, and but for reasons, and creating the character Captain Jack Harkness and bringing him, who's in that. That's one of the reasons why the Empty Child Doctor dances is so good.
Yes.
It's because of
the introduction of that character.
That uh-huh. and the t-shirt.
Yes.
But the which is like one of the last lines of the episode is where Jack Harkness says to Rose Tyler, really great t-shirt, by the yeah. way. But anyway.
But also, Davis brought in a lot of writers who had worked both on The Virgin and later BBC books, novels, and who wrote the Big Finish audios.
Because
in fact,
he was
they even adapted, some of the things were adapted from...
Yes.
And starting from the second episode of New Who, of Reboot Who, which is totally, a completely, 100% an homage to... Am I the only one who's ever noticed this?
What?
Where does it take place?
Which this? Which,
the second... Which,
the End of the World.
Yes.
The End of the World.
Yes.
It takes place in the world when Earth's about to blow up.
Where?
Bad Wolf Enterprises.
Yes, but it is the restaurant at the end
God,
of the
that's
universe.
Funny. Oh, that's really
Has
funny.
Has anybody ever noticed that these are all Douglas at the tree lady? All the stuff in there, it's all Douglas Adams.
Wow.
It's pure Douglas Adams. It was a complete homage.
It's also what one of the things I noticed Davis did in the first three episodes was evoke different eras of classic Who.
That's right.
True. Rose was a John Pertwee story, basically.
Yeah.
End of the World was... I was thinking of it as more because it reminded me a lot of the Davison and Colin
Baker
era. Well,
it doesn't have to be only one thing.
It yeah.
easily
yeah. But it felt like
the
one of
setting,
a Nathan Turner thing.
The setting was the restaurant
yes.
at the end
yeah.
of the universe.
Yeah. And then you had the one with Charles Dickens. I'm blanking on the title. Which was a Graham Harper era, yeah. Tom Baker historical story that had the same feel as stuff like the Tales
Very
of Wang Chiang
so.
and some of his other
yes.
and
Horror Fang Rock
and
stuff.
And used
like that.
The classic trope of that era of here's Charles Dickens with the Doctor, here's
yeah.
a famous personage
yeah.
and all that. So, and what's more, the actors. I mean, Chris Eccleston, especially in. The Doctor dances. There is a point when he puts on a smile.
Yeah.
And you're looking at Tom Baker.
Hmm.
That's all there is to it. And at another point, you're hearing a little Colin Baker. And at another point, you're seeing a little Peter Davison. He's doing a little bit. I think the best person to synthesize the Doctors was Matt Smith.
Yeah.
But Eccleston pulled it off, especially his Tom Baker. He did a perfect Tom Baker.
Hmm.
And if you take a look at the restaurant at the end of the universe, at the second episode.
The End of the World.
The End of the World.
Hmm.
Fine. Call it what you
end
will call
it. I'll call it what it's actually called.
Well, detail.
Call me a bluff old traditionalist.
You fans are so picky.
Yes, writers are picky about getting our titles right, too,
Yeah. Not to mention bylines.
Yeah.
But
you're here.
A little bit.
Anyway, Mr. David. David Mack? No. It's in that episode that we are told that he is the last Time Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
It is.
No, it was in Dalek.
Nope.
We learned this.
No, it is at the end after the Earth blows up and they come back to the present. And Rose steps out and she says, "Chips, I smell chips." Believe me, I can quote you this episode.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Beginning to end, I really can. And and first of all, the tree lady, who I love, whatever, she says, "You're the last of your kind." And she's, it's revealed for the first time there. And then later on, he's talking about the planet and how he sees it and how all of his people are gone. There's this very poignant moment at the end of that otherwise comedy episode where he explains how he is the last of the Time Lords. So it's episode 2.
Yeah.
And that is a Big Finish trope.
Mm.
It's out of canon, but at that moment, Davis put it into the canon. As it were, he loaded the cannon.
I actually, you forget that the they actually dolloped out information very slowly as to part of it was because one of the things Davis did brilliantly, I thought, was create a show that was at the same time completely accessible to somebody who had never seen Doctor Who before, and yet still was a continuation of the show that had been on for decades.
There are so many people who are only now realizing about this 50th anniversary thing that the show had a life before 2005. Well,
once the show became a success, Davis and then later, especially Moffat, embraced the show's history much more. Davis kept it initially, especially in Eccleston seasons, to little bits and pieces.
But it was there.
But
if you were looking, it was there. And if you didn't know, it didn't matter.
Exactly. It wasn't until probably Tennant's second season that they really started seriously embracing stuff from the past, just because he could. Because at that point, it was a success. He had the audience, and he could afford to do more continuity gags and stuff like that without it being thinly veiled references. But I also like the way he slowly did the reveal as to what. I mean, we knew that the Doctor was a time traveler who had fought some kind of war. It wasn't until Dalek. What we found out in Dalek was that the Time War was between the Time Lords and the Daleks.
We also know in the episode Rose, the first.
That mentions
episode,
just the
that
Time
he's
War.
Just regenerated.
Yes, that too.
Because he's passing in a mirror and he stops and goes,
don't like
ears.
The ears.
Yeah. Ears. Whereas I recently got new teeth, which is true, and I said right on the air, name the city?
Barcelona.
Thank you.
Yes, right.
And I said right on the air, because I do occasionally civilize and all that because of these new teeth, and the first time on the air that I civilized, I said, new teeth. What was I talking about? Oh, right, Barcelona. And not one listener got the reference, damn it. I know. Jim Ryan here.
And when he was regenerating, when the last episode of Christopher Eccleston, he tells Rose, I wanted to take you to Barcelona, not the city, the planet.
The planet, yes. And by the way, I just happened, they're showing nothing but Doctor Who and BBC America all week.
Of course.
And I just happened to tune in an episode, a Donna Noble episode. Mm-hmm. And there's a reference, and Tennant makes a reference to when I was on Barcelona.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that came back.
Yeah. Yeah, one of these days they may get there with River Song.
And the one thing that Davis also brought to Doctor Who that it never had in its previous iteration was giving... The Doctor's companions were always there mainly to provide, to some extent, an expository function. Initially, they were the first two companions we met really were Ian and Barbara, who were actually as much the protagonists as the Doctor in the early stories.
Not to mention his granddaughter.
Yeah, but it was... You look at some of the early Hartnell episodes, and Ian and Barbara really came across as the protagonists with the Doctor and Susan being the wacky sidekicks.
Yeah.
But as the show progressed and the Doctor, you know, became more to the fore, they still served the function, you know, what's that Doctor? You know, they were there to give the Doctor somebody to talk to and somebody to explain things to.
Like
and
in
also
the early Avengers where Steed was simply the guy that our hero went to get assignments.
Right. Right. And they also sometimes, if you need to split your party, you know, split your party, as any good role player knows that it's wanting to keep the adventure going. You know, you send the companion off in one direction and the Doctor off in another, and then they come together later. Mm-hmm. But the companions always showed up, like, they showed up in the TARDIS, they traveled with the Doctor, but you had no sense beyond the basic trappings of what their life was like before they came on the TARDIS. Like, you knew that Jamie was a Scotsman who fought
in a battle that he was going to die.
In the Battle of Culloden, and because he wore a kilt all the time, and he had a funny accent, so we remembered it all the time. But that was it, you know. Davis actually brought...
backstory.
But yeah, and exterior lives to the companions.
I mean...
I loved when he brings Rose back, and
the name
find
of the
out,
first episode is Rose. We don't see the Doctor for like 10 minutes.
Right. Mm-hmm. But it's specifically when he finally gets her back home, and he overshot by a year... And there are consequences to that because her mother has gone out of her mind.
Right.
Her boyfriend has been questioned by the police repeatedly because they think he killed her.
Right.
And there's all these consequences to their lives, and that's something that
Davis...
But he
ended up blowing up Starfleet, but that's a whole...
Well,
other stuff.
But that's...
I'm sorry, just slipped universes.
Oh, yeah.
But he did.
Yes.
I didn't recognize him until the credits.
Oh, I totally recognized him.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, he did an amazing job in that film.
Yeah.
And I'm blanking on the actor's name now, who played Mickey Smith.
Clark.
Noel Clark. Noel Clark was also in Star Trek Into Darkness, doing remarkably well with very few lines of dialogue. He and the woman who played his wife just did a great deal with facial expressions in that film. It was
playing
a really
guy who Smaug forced blackmailed into.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Or Sherlock, if you prefer that.
He's more Smaug than Khan, I'll tell you that.
Yeah, well. Yeah. But the... That added dimension, I think, really gave a texture to the show that was the one thing that was missing from the previous iteration.
And if you're going to say Sherlock and all that, I do ask you to think of the desolation of Smaug as Holmes and Watson.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And Martin Freeman and Benedict Cumberbatch together again for the first time.
Yes, indeed.
What I liked about the Russell T. Davies version of Doctor Who was the poignancy that many, many episodes had. The Doctor didn't always come across as the hero at times.
That's right.
Those episodes.
Well, that was actually true. There are subtleties in earlier episodes. I mean, Patrick Troughton and William Hartnell could get into downright moods. Tom Baker could be snappish, and he would leave somebody who's been with him for years, like Sarah Jane.
Right.
In the middle of nowhere. Rude. Very often, totally rude. John Pertwee was actually one of the nicer doctors, and he could be snippy.
Yeah, but in the Russell T. Davies era, I mean, the poignancy was really hammered home. In the episode Dalek, the doctor is threatening the Dalek with a big weapon, and the Dalek says, "You would have made
a great Dalek.
And this that is was just
now.
So,
so here's a question I have for the panel.
Yes,
jumping the gun a little bit. Just how much of the Time Wars, of the idea of the whole thing, do we think Russell Davis had in his head in the Chris Eccleston season? And I'll point out a couple of things. Carol just mentioned that thing about the fifth episode, Dalek. I would point out in The Empty Child, the Doctor dances, especially in The Empty Child, the Doctor dances, he's able to save all the characters. Now, there's a high body count, especially in Old Who and often in New Who. And when he does this thing and he does this insane, wonderful, incredible smile, and saying, just this once, everybody lives. Mm-hmm. And you're thinking, does Davies know that this is the doctor who destroyed Gallifrey?
My guess is he had as little detail initially in mind about the Time War, simply because you don't want to hamstring yourself. He had... I'm coming at this from the perspective of somebody who
has
written serial fiction.
This is all hindsight.
My guess would be is that he had the basic idea that it was, you know, the Daleks and the Time Lords fought a war and Gallifrey blew up. I'm not sure he necessarily had the notion of the Doctor destroying it in the first place.
Think about that. That
wasn't established until much later.
But just retroactively, it explains... the whole Dalek thing, the horrid fear of the Dalek.
Although
the glee. No, that's natural, no matter what.
Yeah, because the Daleks are
they're nasty.
The
glee with which he saves everybody after perhaps having been the biggest xenocide since Ender.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know. Not homophobe,
right?
But you know,
yeah.
It's a question.
Yeah, I my guess would be, like I said, as somebody who's written this stuff, is that he only had the basics and filled in stuff later.
Yeah,
I think you could say that it was probably Schrodinger's plot device.
Yeah,
you basically have no idea where it goes until you actually open the box, and if he just leaves the box sitting there, it could
be the cat is alive or dead.
Yes, yeah.
My feeling is I should just try to interview him and find out what
he knew. I think so too, and I'll provide you the recording equipment. But so Russell, so Chris Eccleston lasts only 1 year. Mm-hmm. I have my own theories as to why.
I actually can tell you the answer.
Oh, okay.
I read an interview in SFX magazine, which is a very wonderful, wonderful British science fiction magazine.
Yes.
And he said he just wanted to do 1 year.
Yeah, well, okay. I don't buy it.
Oh, you don't?
I don't buy it at all, one bit.
Okay, I do buy it partly because of things I've heard from other people who know him and have interviewed him. It isn't just this.
It's what he says.
It's been a consistent trait of his career throughout his entire career. He does a role, and then when he's done with it, he's done with it.
He didn't have that much of a career before that. He did individual movies.
Right.
He didn't have a series beforehand. So there's no pattern. There are too many things that point to why it would not have been that way if they had preferred. Starting with, in all the Doctor Who confidentials, which we don't get here, and they stopped doing last year, for every single 48-minute episode, there was a 48-minute documentary that went with every episode that I watch faithfully. In every single post Eccleston thing. In the 50th anniversary, where they're bringing in various doctors to do various things, where they're interviewing everybody ever associated with the show, his name is not even mentioned, okay? He doesn't exist except to talk about the Ninth Doctor and the reboot of the series. He is divorced from the show. He never shows up on Torchwood. Both David Tennant and Matt Smith ended up in the Sarah Jane Adventures. These things cross over and cross fertilize. Peter Davison has shown up on a minisode.
Yeah.
And all that. Chris Eccleston does not. I'll tell you the exact line where I think this is totally surmise on my own part.
Okay.
And it goes back to the Doctor dances. When they're saving Captain Jack from certain death, and Rose and the Doctor are dancing to the hits of the 40s, because it is the middle of World War II in the Blitz.
Yeah.
And Rose says, come on in, I'm sure he'd like to dance. And the Doctor says, yes, but who with? Now, we know that Jack is a person whose sexual philosophy is, if it moves, good enough.
Omnisexual was the technical term.
Yeah.
And I know a number of people who worked at Omni, but we're not going there.
Yeah.
At any rate, sorry, Ellen. Sorry, Ellen. Sorry, Ellen. And once more, sorry, Ellen. But don't want to be in trouble.
Though. No.
She's great people. Thing at that moment was somebody at the Beeb all of a sudden said, we've got this wonderful writer who wrote Queer as Folk. He's put in a bisexual character, and all of a sudden there's a question about the Doctor. Is he perhaps, because the Doctor's sexuality, outside of a single snog in the movie version, has never really been dealt with until Billy Piper turns up. And now we've got an equally gorgeous character, male, and the whole show's getting a little bit more adult. Before Eccleston left the show, he said there was a parting of the ways, which by coincidence is the name of his last episode. And I think that they were having a grand time maturing Doctor Who. And they were not allowed to do it. Exit Chris Eccleston forever and a day. Enter David Tennant, and his first episodes are almost infantile in the pandering to the 8-year-old. And the biggest problem in David Tennant years are that every so often those episodes are just for that 8-year-old kid, possibly behind a sofa or not, and at the same time, Torchwood is born. Torchwood, the anagram of Doctor Who, mm-hmm. and you want to do something in what here we call Safe Harbor, and there they call outside of the watershed hours. You can have your adult show over there, Mr. Davis, but on Doctor Who, you're family friendly. And I think there was the parting of the ways.
The BBC, I worked on a Doctor Who anthology that I edited in, that came out in 2008, called The Quality of Leadership. It was published by Big Finish. Big Finish continued to have the license for a while to do short story anthologies based on the first eight Doctors. So you could only use 1 through 8. And I put together an anthology called The Quality of Leadership. It had stories by a bunch of people who had never written Doctor Who fiction before, including Peter David and Diane Duane.
Wow. Who are all major writers.
Star Trek yes. writers.
Yes. As well as people who had written quite a bit of Star Trek fiction, like Una McCormick.
Tie-in fiction.
Yeah. Una McCormick actually had never written Doctor Who before, but has written a bunch since, and that was her first one. Also veterans like Steve Saville and James Swallow. And... But when I had to work with the BBC to get for approvals on everything, and one of the things I learned very quickly putting that anthology together is that the BBC considers Doctor Who primarily to be a children's show.
Yeah,
that's right. Mm-hmm.
And
always has been.
And yes. I say this by way of more or less agreeing with your point that if they tried to maturify it, which is a word I just made up, there would be pushback from the BBC on that.
And I think that's what happened. And I think that's where retrofittingly we can say Chris Eccleston only wanted to do 1 year.
That's possible.
Obviously they don't get along. They being Doctor Who, the entirety of it, and Chris Eccleston. Mm. He won't be interviewed, he won't appear, he won't comment, not in print, not in radio, not in television. He's gone.
But I think it's because he's a thespian. He's an actor. He does a role and he leaves a role.
We're talking about an actor being interviewed about a role they did. They love to do that.
He does.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Check out the DVD of the movie Elizabeth. Okay, where he's interviewed about the role. I'm sorry. He does interviews about his roles. He played a Hasidic rabbi in something. He talked about that.
We're assuming, of course, isn't actually doing that. And considering the number of surprises...
Yes, Carol,
the name of the movie is escaping me.
Yeah,
very
I
good.
Don't
he
remember.
He was great in it, too.
He was brilliant. Yeah. He was brilliant.
Yeah, but that's...
Price of Ruby, sorry.
excellent. Uh-huh.
But we're assuming, of course, that he didn't actually do this, and part of his act is just to keep people from seeing that he's doing it, and that possibly within the next 72 hours he might show up in something.
There is that. Yeah. There is that. Mm-hmm. One can only hope. Mm-hmm. That would be quite a switch. I mean, but
how many people thought Paul McGann was showing up this week?
I did.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I thought he was showing up on Saturday.
Oh.
And instead he showed up a little sooner.
Yes. Because Paul McGann in real life is John Hurt. But we'll get to that.
Yes.
And I said that months and months ago, and I was right.
Mm.
Well, no, you weren't.
Mm. Exactly. Okay, we'll get into that.
Yeah.
You were
right and wrong at the same time.
Uh-huh. Okay. very likely.
Yeah.
Moving along, just to get to the present.
Yes. Yes.
David Tennant becomes a beloved doctor because he's a real heartthrob. Not like Chris Eccleston was hard for women... and men to go wow over.
Yeah, but his ears were funny.
But yes, but his attitude was so cool.
Oh yeah.
He was so cool.
Yeah.
And Tennant, he could occasionally just do things that were so joyous or fierce or whatever. He's a wonderful, wonderful actor. And while some of the episodes he did were infantile, some of the acting he did and some of the episodes he did were incredible.
Actually, I think some of the best episodes of Doctor Who were his time, his tenure.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I agree. Yeah. I agree. Blink.
Blink.
Yeah.
He also, one word, blink.
Yeah. One of the things I thought was interesting about Tennant's run...
And P.S., that's Moffat.
Yeah.
Yes, I know. Yeah.
Tennant was a very, I thought, traditional doctor. He was your basic doctor. He was, you know, a funny looking guy who said ridiculous things and acted a little shouty, and ultimately had a good heart and saved
But he could also get very stern.
Yeah, that was the thing that actually I noticed And I still hold to this, that there was an attempt. His first story was The Christmas Invasion.
Right.
Yes.
Which was the first of what has now become traditional Christmas special every year. And
after the minisode, yes. Right. He did a minisode, which everybody forgets about.
Yes.
I forgot.
Yeah, because they never showed it here.
But his...
Rose meets the new doctor before the TARDIS crash lands and he gets out in his pajamas.
Oh, I'm not Ginger? I so wanted to be Ginger.
Thank you. they show that as in Children in Need, which is also... Which is also where they did the Peter Davison mashup and a few other little bits. But they were trying in The Christmas Invasion to make this doctor be a little darker. And, you know, from now on, no mercy and basically destroying Harriet Jones' career for no good reason.
No good reason.
And the problem was...
I'm still PO'd about
it. So am I. And it didn't work. Tennant's Daffy charm didn't fit the original idea of where they wanted to go with the Doctor. They wound up adjusting him. You didn't really see that element of the Doctor until toward the very end.
They had to find the right thing, and this is something that I had an argument about on the panel of Phil Kahn that was pro or con Stephen Moffat, where somebody said, you have all these different people writing it, so it goes from one to the other. I said, no, that's American television. In British television, your showrunner today has finished knowing what the 13th episode will be before the first episode is filmed. I promise you right now, Stephen Moffat knows what the 13th Peter Capaldi episode will be about.
Hmm.
He really does. So the showrunner is responsible for it.
Well, that's true in American television, too, depending on the showrunner.
But I think that started in American television really only with X-Files. I'm not sure that it was ever true before.
Oh, sure it was.
Babylon 5.
No, but before any of those, Dragnet.
Twilight
Zone.
Those
weren't serialized,
A, Twilight Zone is anthology. B, Dragnet had the star as the director-producer.
Yeah.
And C, B5 follows X-Files, unless I'm vastly mistaken.
You're right. But, and also, the part of it is just awareness of that sort of thing. But also, Hill Street Blues was doing this sort of thing before.
You're right there. Yeah. Steve Bochco
I think Bochco would probably fit as that.
Bochco's is about
84
or so.
Yeah. Hill Street Blues started in 81.
Name the first episode of the fourth season of Babylon 5. Let me do a station break. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf.
My name is Jim probably Freud. Think we should have only been on for 15 minutes, but we haven't.
Yes, and with me, but this is our Doctor Who special, which began thanks to Robert Knight at 12 midnight.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
With me are Carol Kinchevsky.
Dave
Ryan. Thank you. James Ryan and Keith Orton.
You blew all three of our names. Well done.
I'm doing well.
Hey, at least you're consistent.
Okay, so the name of the episode?
Hour of the Wolf.
Thank you. The definition of which he totally blew. Straczynski totally blew it.
Well,
the character Ivana says that Hour of the Wolf. Ivanova, whatever her name is. Claudia Christian.
You're not getting any
says,
names right.
Yeah, that's it. I'm done with names. Claudia Jewish says...
You're acting much like she did it, which is why she's off the air these days.
Exactly.
Oh, but have you seen her Facebook page?
I have
dear.
Not.
Oh my God, it's hysterical. She is I think, trying to be the new George Takei. She's like angling into the George Takei.
Yeah, I think she was always sort of there. Uh-huh.
Oh, but she posted this amazing picture of herself from one of her first acting jobs. Her head in a refrigerator. She's girl in a refrigerator.
You
got to start somewhere.
At any rate, she says that Hour of the Wolf is his time. It's about 3 a.m. Uh-huh. when you're thinking about things and thoughts are the heavy... Sorry, wrong. Blank. Hour of the Wolf is an ancient, ancient concept. Vargtimen in the Swedish. It is the time, it is the morning twilight, okay? It is the time between night and dawn. It is not dawn, it is not night, it is the morning twilight. And remember, in Sweden, by the way, that can be for many hours. Mm-hmm. And there's a movie called Hour of the Wolf, after which this radio show is named, directed by a fellow named Ingmar Bergman from 1967. And it's fully explained there, and Bergman explains it's a 2,000-year-old concept. So I'm sorry, Mr. Straczynski.
Well, this is also.
But you're not bitter about that at all.
I mean, this is also the same guy who thought, I'm willing to give up my wife for my mother.
What?
One more day.
That's right.
Yes.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah.
I was just thinking of some of a scene in the Spider-Man comics.
Oh, I didn't read that.
Yes. Save yourself the trouble.
Well, that was, in his defense, that was an editorial directive, not, you know, he made the best.
I was only following orders.
Back,
sir.
It was gonna happen even if he didn't.
Back to move.
Still.
Okay, David Tennant had some of the best episodes ever of the modern era.
Yes.
And best episodes ever, you know, period, bar.
Satan Pit, Impossible Planet.
I had problems with Satan Pit.
Oh, yeah. No, I loved that episode. Love that two-parter.
The problem is, why did it have to be Satan?
It just had to be some ancient evil.
Okay, there are lots of them.
Yeah, but
although I like Satan. The fact that they brought back the same guy who did
and that's a Christian, yes. and that's a specifically Christian one. And for COE, that's fine. For this Jew, it doesn't go very far. Okay, Ms. Pinchevsky. So
I'm not Christian.
Almighty Quibble is our show.
That's my point. That's my point. That's my point. In England, a lot of COE stuff is taken for granted. The fact that everybody is Church of England.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not true anymore. No. They have a very large Muslim population, large Hindu population.
That's true, but it's in there. Sorry, but it's still in the culture.
It's in the pop culture the same way that...
Yeah, you know, for everybody who lives there.
The same way that in American pop culture,
it's
mostly white people.
Lenny Bruce said it. Every New Yorker is a Jew.
Yes.
I don't care if you're in charge of the archdiocese. Every New Yorker is a Jew. That's a fact. That's it. Lenny Bruce was right, and every Brit is, every Englishman, every English person is COE.
Yeah. What was interesting watching Tennant's run, because Tennant became the most popular doctor in the modern era,
He's also the first one where Eccleston was rebirthing it and pulling from different ones. Tennant eventually became his own doctor.
Yes.
I think Eccleston did too, honestly. I mean, he used a lot of elements.
He did, eventually. I think he would have more so.
Honestly. But no other doctor would have been boogieing to Tainted Love.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was pure Eccleston right there. And that was the moment that I was completely sold on him. Was when it just... I still have that as an animated GIF on my computer, bobbing back and forth.
I was sold on him with saying, "Pleased to meet you, Rose Tyler.
Run!"
Yes. Yeah, so I was sold then. But
what was interesting was watching when Eccleston announced he was leaving and watching the outrage from people who, of course, were relatively new to Doctor Who and didn't realize that he was the ninth person to play the role rather than the first. And then 3 years later, those same people were saying, "Oh my God, you can't possibly replace David Tennant." They didn't know what they were talking about in 2005, and they didn't know what they were talking about in 2009.
When I saw the interview with Matt Smith, I was worried.
It took a while for him to grow on me. I didn't.
But, no, I liked him.
But what was especially hilarious was Tennant achieved a popularity that no doctor had since Tom Baker.
Right.
That's and it true. Was exactly yes. the same phenomenon.
Yes.
The outrage when he decided he was going to go, how can we possibly replace this guy? And then replacing him with the youngest person ever to play the Doctor.
Yeah. Very good points.
Yeah.
And
Spanish behavior always comes around again.
I will say one thing, though. I really, really, really dislike a lot of what Davis did in the end of time with the final... Tennant episode, where it's all this germ and drunk, and it's known that the doctor's going to die. He's not going to die. He's going to change personality. He will be the same person, as River pointed out to him on more than one occasion by that time. He's going to have many lives, and he's going to be married to her through many of them. Mm-hmm. He's not going to die, but he's doing this whole farewell for everything, which is stuff and nonsense. He saw Sarah Jane, yes.
And he also, what made that infinitely worse, you asked us to describe Doctor Who before, and one of the things I said was that he flies around in a time machine, and he goes to different places, and he helps people.
Yes.
That's the most important part. He helps people. It was established, one of my favorite little throwaway lines, it was established I think it was Last of the Time Lords, the one that came right before it. He chose that name specifically because the Doctor is not the name he was born with, but it was the name he chose because he helps people. He is right. The one who helps people.
Mm-hmm.
In an episode that I have always liked and most people hate, Peter Davison episode called Warriors of the Deep. It's one of those episodes.
I like
that.
Sorry.
Oh yeah. No, I didn't like that.
Yeah,
one
most
at
people
all.
Don't. Jim, you and I are the only two people in the world who like that episode. But it ends with basically a doctor standing in a room full of corpses, and he's staring out at this, and all he can think is, there should have been another way.
Yeah.
And that's the Doctor.
That's
right
what I liked about it.
And then, you know, what you've cited any number of times, which is, you know, everybody lives.
Yeah.
For that character, that person whose entire modus operandi is to help people, to carry on like trash for 5 minutes, whining about
five
having to
minutes?
Regenerate.
3 hours!
Well, yeah. Whining about having to regenerate.
Although I love Will.
In order to save the life of somebody who is a friend of his. There shouldn't have been any hesitation there at all.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's the Doctor. When he realized Wolf's life was in danger, sorry, now I'm doing. See, he's infecting us with his
name
screwing up thing. Bernard, Wolf's Cribbins. Life was in danger. There should have been no hesitation on his part. He should have pushed the button and saved his life.
I've been
period.
Seeing old Peter Sellers movies from the early 1960s with Bernard Cribbins, and it's
wonderful. Yeah, he's
have
great.
He's done tons of.
Oh yeah.
Have you heard his music on YouTube?
No.
Oh my goodness, he does this great song about moving a piano.
Oh my god, I'm going to have to check that
out. Go to YouTube
out.
And just type in Bernard Cribbins.
Okay, well, I use a different Google service, Google Music. But,
oh, right. Uh-huh.
I'll tell you why I think that episode is as weepy and heart-wrenching and pulling out all the stops.
Mind him going on the farewell tour. That
no, I liked the farewell tour. I liked that.
It was the whining.
It was the whining. He says, I don't want to die. Yeah. And my answer is, you're not going to, you little wuss.
Glowy crap's going to come out of your hands and you'll look like somebody else.
But part of him that made him Dr. Ten was going to die. And I felt it the entire episode. Like,
but
oh,
you see
God,
that
every inch that he traveled.
But that's not the character.
That's how
you as the viewer react, and that makes sense.
But you see, there's a third meta on that, and I think that this is my guess again, was the real one. It's Davey's leaving.
Oh, right.
It's not that Tennant, the 10th Doctor, is going to die. Tennant is leaving. His husband has brain cancer.
Oh, right.
He can't work on... I think he did...
No. That didn't come till later, because he did...
That didn't come till later? Yes. I was going to ask.
That's why there hasn't been any more Torchwood.
But okay, so he still did Torchwood.
Yeah, he did two more seasons of Torchwood.
That's right.
Right. Yeah.
Up until Miracle Day, that's right.
Yeah,
and
it was after Miracle Day that he stopped. Day. Yeah.
And by the way, if you want to talk about going to YouTube and watching great performances by Whovian actors... Help me, Laura. Red hair. The PR person in Miracle Day.
Lauren Ambrose.
Lauren Ambrose, who's going to be playing Fanny Bryce in Funny Girl on Broadway.
Oh my goodness.
Wait for it.
Wow.
She is going to, you know, and this is not going to be Barbara Streisand's Fanny Bryce.
It's going to be Fanny Bryce's Fanny Bryce?
No, it's going to be Lauren Ambrose's. And if you want a taste of what that is, you go to YouTube and you type in Lauren Ambrose, my man, and prepare to be floored.
Wow.
I mean, she is yes. Yeah. Anyway. It was Davis leaving Doctor Who, which is why it's so
histrionic.
Yeah. And histrionic. I loved
every painful crawl through the morass of his life. I think
some of it was a certain amount of fan service, as Carol is demonstrating. Well,
it wasn't
the Doctor complaining, it was David Tennant complaining.
And on the one hand, there's nothing wrong with that, because if you're not pandering to the fans, why are you doing Doctor Who?
I'm a fan. I've pandered
on the other hand, there's the historic view. And it has to be remembered, we're turning over a baton. We're not ending the race.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Enter Matt Smith.
And enter Stephen Moffat.
Actually,
Moffat entered first, technically. He was the cast Smith.
Now, and let's, by the way, just deal with the name Moffat for a second.
Okay.
Peter Davison's real name?
It's Peter Moffat.
Oh,
that's right.
Yes. Yeah.
His daughter's name?
Catherine?
Georgina
Moffat.
Moffat. Yes. Georgina Moffat plays the Doctor's daughter, as played by David Tennant, who then goes and marries her, so that the fifth Doctor becomes the tenth Doctor's father-in-law, and his daughter becomes his wife. Okay?
So that's not weird at all!
So if you want to talk about how these things, just throw, what do they call the charts?
Family tree?
No.
Venn diagram.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
The Venn diagrams. Thank you, Jim. Just throw those totally out of whack.
Considering I just finished reading David Gerrold's The Man Who Folded Himself, no, it's not weird at all.
By the way, add one letter to The Man Who Folded Himself. I always called it The Man Who Fondled Himself. Which brings up another...
Which is a Twitter meme, but anyway.
which, by the way, brings up another theory that is mine.
Okay.
That brontosauruses are very thin. No.
Goodness.
It's good. It took us 2 hours before we got our first Python reference.
No, we already mentioned John Cleese at the Louvre.
And Terry Jones, for that matter. So, all right.
Yeah, that's right. But
and all of whom decided to take advantage of everybody looking at England to say, hey, we're getting back together again.
Yeah.
Yay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Totally.
So now we're talking about Matt Smith, but I had a problem with Matt Smith from the beginning, but it wasn't just Matt Smith being kind of goofy. I had a problem with Amy Pond from the absolute beginning.
Oh?
Yeah.
And I know what you're going to say, and I disagree.
No, you don't.
Okay, let's see.
All right. Oh, you think I'm going to talk about the tardy dress?
The handcuffs.
No. That does bother me quite a bit. But the first episode in which they pick up and they go to another planet. I forgot the name of the episode, but it was the second episode.
Oh, the second episode. Yeah, 11th Hour was the first one.
Right, so it's not at the outset, because that's already the second episode.
Yeah, so... Yeah, a little bit of nails on blackboard when we first met her for me. But then the second episode, she's on a planet with on a spaceship. Vicky Ten was the one of the characters. Vicky Ten. That was kind of cool, actually, that part. But she is told to just wander and not make trouble and just lay low.
Oh, is that the one with Queen Elizabeth?
Yeah,
yes. Lizzie Ten.
Liz Ten. Sorry, not Vicky Ten. Liz Ten. And And the first thing she does is, break into a room that says, do not enter. And I think, this girl's a sociopath.
She's just Lois Lane.
No.
Or every other Doctor Who companion.
She's breaking, she's breaking and entering. Oh, my God.
No, I'm sorry. That's every Doctor Who companion. That's Ian and Barbara, who aren't supposed to go into the TARDIS to begin with. They've been told stay out by more than one person, and they go in.
I mean, you could make an argument that one of the main sub-themes within Doctor Who is that you're going to walk away from convention and just... I mean, the whole thing about wandering.
What about Adam?
Yeah. well.
The kid in the museum who who does nothing the doctor tells him and ends up being deserted on another planet as a result.
Back home.
Earth. No, he brought him back.
Back on Earth. But it's a meme.
Like that.
It's a regular meme. That this is what companions do.
Well, not just companions. I mean, the doctor himself. I mean, he's not exactly what you'd call an upstanding citizen.
That's right.
He steals his time machine.
Rule number one?
What?
Sometimes the doctor lies.
Oh. Yeah.
Yes. Rule number two.
If he tells the truth, check rule
this
number
is
one.
My, this is mine.
Oh.
This is mine. This is especially about Moffat. The showrunner lies.
That's been true of every showrunner since they invented the internet. But
it's been true of the internet.
Well, yeah. Every time the Doctor shows up somewhere in the TARDIS, he's breaking and entering most of the time. Yeah.
That's right. But he stole the TARDIS.
There was just something about Amy Pond that just was nails on blackboard. I mean,
well, that's how I felt about Rose Tyler in her second.
Yeah, that's how I felt about Rose Tyler.
Not in her first,
eventually. Not in the first, but not in the beginning with David Tennant because I liked the transition. But they had to write her out of the series. They just had to. The clinging Rose thing that they did was
my biggest issue with Tennant was that Rose was perfect for Eccleston because Rose was exactly what Eccleston needed at that point.
Yes,
he needed somebody to basically bring him back to himself.
Yeah.
After Eccleston was basically the PTSD doctor.
Yes, exactly.
And Tennant though was more in line with what Rose helped him become. The problem was he didn't really need her at that point, and they were too much alike. Mm-hmm. So that was my fingernails on a chalkboard was Tennant with Rose. It just didn't work for me. Yeah. I honestly thought it worked best when they brought a third person into it, where especially when Mickey started traveling.
Yeah. Yes,
it
yes.
worked so much better.
It really did, and that is also true of Amy. Is that Amy
was
starts
much
working so much better when Rory comes on board?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
But that was a calculated thing, and I have to say that my favorite series of Who, one series, one year. Is what they call Series 5, which is really what, Season
31.
31, thank you. It is, first of all, one thing we didn't mention about Russell Davies that he was a genius on. We've mentioned it, but it has to be acknowledged. Bad Wolf. From the very beginning, I'm not sure if there's one in Rose, but starting at the end of the world, or the restaurant at the end of the world, starting with that, we have references to Bad Wolf until it builds and builds and builds and becomes what the entire season is about.
Didn't it start with the Charles Dickens episode?
No, it started.
It started End of the World.
End of the World. Right, it's the Bad Wolf Corporation runs the restaurant.
Right.
Uh-huh. So it's right there. It's right there in episode 2.
It wasn't in the first episode, I don't think.
I don't think it was, but I've looked for it. Yeah. But it's in every single one after that, and it gets the graffiti on the side of the TARDIS, this and that and the other. It's really, the way that it is ultimately displayed, even though sort of like a weak meme kind of thing, just like what they did with Jenna Coleman and The Matrix. But the way Davis pulled that off was sheer genius. They tried to do that since, but not quite as well. Now,
didn't work as well with Torchwood and Tennant's first season at all.
But, right. Yeah. So, but really, really worked for the first Matt Smith series is Amelia Pond, little girl. What is she? 7?
Yes.
The one he had fish fingers and custard with.
Yeah.
I'll be back in 5 minutes.
Yeah.
5 minutes becomes 12 years. Is it any surprise that at that point she's making a living? She has in her head. She can't deal with her boyfriend, who's a nurse, although there's also the software programmer, don't start, Carol, who's this really good-looking kind of a guy who we think she's going to go for. But the doctor veers him off. The doctor, from moment number one, when he realizes that he has screwed up this little girl's life, becomes her father figure, even though she sees him as something stronger.
As a tasty bit of crumpet?
That's right. And what's more, she is going to consume that bit of crumpet right after the Vampires of Venice. Mm. Because at the end of that episode, she, like, puts him up against the TARDIS. He turns her around, they disappear, and fans through the known verse can be heard screaming, "No!" As was I. No. As was I.
No one louder than me.
No, there was somebody louder than you. There was a real tempest afoot. Which is to say, Tempest Bradford was on my show that week, and she was, oh my God, was she. So, anyway, so, yeah, no one louder than you, Tempest, Barbara, and me. It was like, wrong, within 1 minute of the, it was just a brilliant gotcha. 1 minute into the next episode, they straighten that out. The doctor is like, no, not going to happen. And he goes to Rory and brings Rory to her. There, at all points, he is the broker of their marriage. It starts with little Amelia, who is then orphaned because of the alternate universe that is created because of the crack. And it ends with her restored to her parents. Something borrowed, something blue. She has the wedding, and she and the doctor dance, and it's a perfect Connie Willis-like. And Connie had never seen Doctor Who at that point. I was yelling.
Really?
Yeah, can you imagine?
Huh. Oh, no.
Can you imagine?
No,
I was yelling at her at a con. It was like, of all people who write great, 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 wonderful time travel comedy dramas, you've never seen Doctor Who?
That's shocking.
Yeah, it really is. Now, of course, you know, well, other story.
Yeah.
Because she found the time. But that one arc, ending with the Pandoricum opens, that, yes, there are weak and bad episodes in there, and there always are when Mark Gatiss gets involved.
Yes.
But I love Mark Gatiss on Sherlock, yes. Not so much on Who.
And, I mean, there's always weak episodes of every series. I mean,
there really is. Yes. But that particular series, from beginning to end, is a strong, strong arc. And the thing that, for me, makes Amy work, and how many times in that season alone do they kill off Rory? The thing that makes three is the answer, by the way.
Wow. What makes it work?
What makes it work is that the doctor is her father figure, even though she doesn't see him that way. They're going against the Martha Smith, the Martha Jones loves John Smith meme. Yeah. That was typical in the Davis era, and that got cloying as well. Which
that was one of the reasons why I liked
Donna Noble
so much. That finally we don't have a companion who's a dewy-eyed young thing who's making goo-goo eyes at the doctor.
Until they destroy that.
Well, yes.
With the Superman kiss.
Yeah.
What?
The Superman kiss is where Superman...
But...
That's in essence what they did to Donna.
Well, yeah, I mean...
That's exactly what they do to Donna. They take away her entire memory.
Right.
She never had that adventure. She goes from being this annoying, clinging person to becoming this strong, vibrant woman with lots to do, lots to say, and all that. And in the library, she meets the perfect man.
Right.
She has a lifetime in memory, and but because he has a slight stutter, they just miss each other. And then at the end of the thing, even when she goes back to the mundane life and her grandfather knows what happens and she's not allowed to, she gets married again and she doesn't even find this perfect guy. My heart was broken. What they did to Donna, just plain old seven words. Just sucks.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. But I just loved her too because she wasn't.
Yes, I loved her.
The doctor.
But I love. Yes.
And I love the fact that she and Tennant then went on to play Beatrice and Benedict in Midsummer Nights.
Much Ado.
Much Ado About Nothing.
Right, yeah.
Yes. Yet another Much Ado.
YouTube classic, because you can find it on YouTube.
There's the Doctor Who Much Ado, and there's the Firefly.
Yeah.
Yes. Much it's not just Firefly.
I'm sorry, where did you say?
Joss Whedon.
Where did you say the YouTube?
The YouTube, yeah, just go to YouTube. I find so many wonderful things.
Don't tell anybody.
Okay.
They'll issue a takedown. I've got to get this tonight. Damn it. Anyway, they monitor us, you know. Actually, they did at one point. I'm not joking. Mm. They don't anymore, but the Beeb used to.
So we shouldn't talk about the alien conspiracies?
No. We can save that for next
time. Thanks a lot!
Jeez! Okay, let me just put these. Okay, can I let these tentacles out now? Oh, that feels no much better. Let's not do the farting jokes. But so you see, I liked Amy in that series. I liked individual episodes with Amy, especially the one where she is, where this the young and the old Amy.
The girl who waited.
Yeah, the girl who waited.
The girl who waited. That is a killer. That is a dynamite.
One of the things I love about that episode, and it's one of the things that is one of the hallmarks of Moffat as a writer that he does that nobody else has ever done in 50 years on Doctor Who. Moffat is the only writer who actually embraces the fact that it's a show about time travel. For every other writer of the show treats time travel as the mode by which the story gets started or the mode
just
by
a
which
place
the doctor
to go
gets
to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And very occasionally it'll get used more than once in the story. Moffat is the only, and this goes back to Moffat's first story was actually in a short story anthology that was also had my first Doctor Who story in it. Back in 1996, it was one of Virgin's Decalogue anthologies, and Moffat did a story called Continuity Errors. Yeah. If you read Continuity Errors, you will see the first draft of A Christmas Carol.
Wow.
It is not still in print as far as I know.
No, and no
although,
e-book.
Although if you go to eBay, you can find an autographed copy on sale from me.
Okay.
Okay.
Because I've got an extra copy that I found in my garage. And as of last time I checked, the bid's up to $46 for the book. It's out of print, and you can find it on Amazon for
Until the e-book comes out, and then it's worth bupkis.
Even though it's Moffat's first story, they haven't released it on
eBook. Wow, that's bizarre.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one of Virgin's, and I know
there are probably rights issues.
There might be rights issues, because there are some original characters that still belong to Virgin after they lost the license. They actually continue to do Bernice Summerfield adventures, and in fact, Moffat's story has Bernice Summerfield in it, who is a character created for the Virgin New Adventures. But anyway, Moffat's story, it's basically the rough draft of A Christmas Carol.
Mm.
Yeah. Where he keeps going back into somebody's life and adjusting it.
Which I liked, but that's the girl in the fireplace also.
Yeah. Which was also Moffat.
Yes.
Yeah, I know, but I preferred the girl in the fireplace to the Christmas Carol.
Right.
It's a Jewish thing.
Yeah.
What can I do? I love Dickens. I just didn't care that much.
But the specific structure of Christmas Carol is closer to what he did in Continuity.
Yes, absolutely. Right.
And it was just and I loved that story when I first read it back when the book came out, because it really dove into what time travel means, and The Girl Who Waited is another one that does that really well. Blink actually is one of
well, Blink
best.
Is the ultimate one, and also the Pandoricum opens,
and of course the one Moffat story where he really takes it to the full extent. His first script, The Curse of the Fatal Death.
Yes, absolutely. Talk about
that
non-canon,
was his first script?
And when you talk about how many doctors are there? There were 8 in that episode alone, I think.
No, there were 4.
4? Yeah. Only 4?
9, 10, 11.
Okay, there are 2 people named Laurie. Not Laurie.
Two
people.
It was
5. There were 2 brothers.
5, you're right, it was 5.
Rowan Atkinson, Richard Grant.
Jim Broadbent.
Hugh Grant.
And then finally, Joanna Lumley.
Yes.
Okay, 5.
That was 1999?
96 or
something. No, it was 99.
Because it has to be after the 8th Doctor.
I saw that at the Millennium Dome in London.
Oh, cool.
It was premiered there in the Millennium Dome.
It
would have
been 99 then.
Very good.
And it was really, I wasn't sure if that's the one, but really it was wonderful.
It's one of those cases, I watched that and I think how unfortunate it is that Rowan Atkinson did that for the same reason why I'm kind of sorry Cary Elwes did Men in Tights, because both Cary Elwes would have made a good straight Robin Hood.
Yeah.
And Rowan Atkinson would make a perfectly good doctor.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I have to say that the later Amy and Rory years wore on me. Mm-hmm. I did not care for the later Moffat showrunner seasons. I thought the whole impossible astronaut thing didn't work. I am bored by the silence.
The intro to the silence was quite frightening.
Was decent, they did. But he has a problem, and he did this with his best villains of all time, the Weeping Angels.
Right.
He overuses it.
Yeah.
He goes back and milks something that, you know, has already been made cheese of. He turns his milk into cheese.
Well, the whole show did that with the Daleks, but...
Absolutely.
Actually, honestly, I would have been... I think the world would be a better place if Dalek was the only Dalek episode we ever got.
Possibly.
It was never going to happen because they paid the Terry Nation Estate flipping great wadges of cash for the rights to use the Daleks, so that's why we always get a Dalek episode every year, no matter how bad it is, and as we saw in the Daleks Take Manhattan, it can get pretty bad.
Saw Asylum of the Daleks, and I thought that was wonderful.
That was, yes. And there have been
even then, when you think about it, it's not really about the Daleks, is it? It could have been any...
Yes.
It could have been...
It was, but the fact that it was
she could have turned into K-9. I mean, you know...
But it was more effective with it being the Daleks because of the history there.
Right.
But it was more effective, but didn't have to be.
But so many of the Dalek episodes are just terrible.
Yeah.
And they're all contractual obligations.
Especially.
But then there's Genesis of...
I'm talking specifically in the modern... Because in the modern era, they had to specifically buy the rights.
And the worst modern era Dalek episode? Winston Churchill.
No. Daleks Take Manhattan was much worse.
Can I borrow that idea, though?
I liked parts of
that. You suggested a great episode.
What?
The contractual obligation of the Daleks.
Litigate! Litigate! You must prepare to litigate!
Not bad, and you overmodulated the mic as well. In this case...
Appropriately.
An appropriate... Uh-huh. Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. Exactly.
I aim to please.
maybe it's because the Daleks Take Manhattan basically pissed all over the history of my city, and so I was a little more pissy about it than I would be in other circumstances.
Yeah, it's an alternate universe.
No, it isn't!
Because that Empire State Building never existed.
Oh, no, no.
But I want to go back to
Thing
why
I can't say on
Amy
Radio,
Pond. But I want to go back to...
We're broadcasting from there right now. So.
Right.
Yeah. Can but, a little more about why I hate Amy Pond?
Yeah.
Okay.
It has to do with the playing with time. Mm-hmm. The reason I dislike her so intensely is because all of her character comes from The Girl in the Fireplace, which was a Russell T. Davies show run episode, Moffat wrote that, and it's just so painful to see that he's taken a little girl that the doctor met this little girl, and then keeps coming in and out of her life. It's the same thing. Amy Pond's character was totally recycled.
Yeah, but he did it well in series 5. It's after that it goes south.
Mm. And also that's
and by the way, there are problems with The Girl in the Fireplace that we don't have.
I loved that episode.
But it's something actually.
It's got very good things, but there are some.
It's also a theme that
minor ones.
One of the big Finnish anthologies did before the show came back was I can't remember the title of it, but it was basically the Doctor interacting with one person throughout. It was called something like Centenarian or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Over 100 years of one person's life, the Doctor interacting with this person throughout that person's life.
Yeah,
various different.
Which, by the way, by the way, The Man Who Walked Home by James Tiptree Jr.
Yes.
Okay, long before Moffat, there was Alice B. Sheldon.
The other thing he did that he's done as a writer and as a showrunner, and he introduced it as a writer, is the Doctor meeting somebody out of sequence with River Song. I love the fact that his meetings with River aren't in the same timeline
now,
as themselves.
That is very cool.
Yeah.
Now, River Song is probably one of my favorite characters of all time, period, bar none, maybe more than the Doctor.
I would love to see the River and Rory show. that's the show I
well,
want to
I,
see.
Well, another, I mean, if you want to talk about getting PO'd about something, when for no good reason the Weeping Angels send Amy and Rory back to the 1930s, where there's not a fixed place and there's no reason on earth No reason on in the TARDIS why the Doctor can't just go back there and say, oh, come along and take them out. Aside from that, they don't get to raise their child.
Right.
And River never gets, as a little girl, to be with her parents. And that would have been right. I had earlier, which was long since disproven, as I've been making broad statements about predictions, and I'm going to make some others. I made one about River Song that has proven to not be possible at that point, but I still like it.
Which is?
River is a future doctor.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Which, by the way, gives a whole new meaning along with David Gerrold.
Yes.
You know,
Diana Fondled himself.
Yes, exactly. It would work, and it would have explained a lot, and I would have just loved the idea of the doctor falling in love with himself. Duh! He always does, doesn't he? For the most part.
Yeah.
But there were problems. Here is a hope, not a prediction, a hope. Let me just say that I can understand why, when they married the Doctor and to River and all that, mm-hmm. and it's a real marriage, there's no question. They tied the knot. They did the whole thing. They literally tied the knot in an old-fashioned ceremony. They are married, and there's all this stuff that she mentions in The Silence of the Library about this wonderful stuff about, you know, the futures that he's got with her and all that. I can understand the BBC's problem of a romantic interlude of any kind between Matt Smith, 28 or 29-year-old at that point, Matt Smith, and 48 or 49-year-old, whatever she is, Alex Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
But Alex Kingston and Peter Capaldi are age appropriate.
Wow.
I want the next bleeping companion to be bleeping River Song. I want the husband and wife to travel together. What a team.
I think they would be brilliant together.
Wouldn't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Wouldn't they?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is anybody in England listening to me? I know it's not going to happen, but please.
Well, I mean, hopefully you'll get what you want and I'd get what I want. And what I would like to see in the future in Doctor Who are Canadians. Let me explain why, because this has always been a problem.
Good luck with this, by the way, even though it's part of the Commonwealth. But.
I mean, well, my problem is
Keegan
that...
Keegan was Australian.
Yeah, I mean, well... My problem is that the program, when it gets started in 1963, is given to us by Sidney Newman, who came to us from Canada. And actually, because he's actually works on another program, Doctor Who has a half-brother, which has existed almost longer than the Doctor has, and didn't have an interruption in the middle there, because Sidney Newman also gave us Hockey Night in Canada.
Ah.
Now... To further buttress the argument, we take the TARDIS to 2005. Russell Davies gets a chance to bring the show back. BBC Wales is told you're going to have to produce it yourself. They don't have the bucks for it. So, when you look at the end card on all of the Chris Eccleston's, they'll say a production of BBC Wales in association with the Canadian Broadcasting
That's
Corporation.
That's right, they do say that. And they, by the way, were given the blame for leaking Rose 2 months before it aired.
Mm.
Do you remember that? Yes, it was all over. Rose was all over the internet about 2 months before it ever aired, and it was claimed that a CBC person by accident let it out. And I'm going, yeah, right, pull the other one that's got bells on it. Mm-hmm. Because it's like, what a rule number two, the showrunner lies. It was the best possible advertising they could have had for Doctor Who saying, oh, by the way, this is going to be good.
I mean, the last time the Canadians answered a call for somebody in England and got this type of response was 1914. Let's hope we don't have that happen again.
Yeah.
I would.
Well, that we know about. 1979 was pretty cool in Iran, but that's.
Well, yeah. That's true. But that wasn't from London. That was from Washington.
Although Paris was more of a table wine that year, according to the.
Well, yes. But it's all thanks to Roger Zelazny.
Right. But I mean, you would think after 50 years, the TARDIS would have landed somewhere in Canada or picked up a Canadian at some point.
Yeah.
Something to honor the Canadian contribution to the show.
Let's really? See. They've
There's
done Australia.
Scottish person. Yeah. Scottish person.
Which we finally saw in Enemy of the World.
Uh-huh. Right.
Huh? Uh-huh. Which?
In Enemy of the World, some of it takes place in the Enemy of the World, the one
episode.
Of the recovered.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Uh-huh.
Patrick Troughton episodes,
right.
Uh-huh. In which Troughton plays this evil.
The evil version of
the shopkeeper to the world.
And leaving no piece of scenery unchewed, may I mention.
Just like the current CEO of Safeco, but that's besides the point.
Right. We've got all the Welsh in.
Torchwood. Yeah.
Yes.
Let's see.
We had
an American, Perry.
Yeah. Was she?
And well, the actress wasn't.
The actress wasn't, but the character was.
Yeah, because her accent kept slipping back and forth.
Yeah, Nicole
Bryant is not. Grace Holloway.
Even if Grace was definitely.
Listen, when you go to an audition. You are what they say you are.
Yeah. Yes, true. Yeah,
you want the job.
Yeah. James Doohan is Canadian.
Yes,
true.
I am.
Yes.
Walter Koenig isn't Russian.
No.
Is anybody who's heard his accent
you
from one half a second notice?
Yeah.
Yes.
By the way, there's a cool thing that...
And David McCallum isn't Russian either.
Right. Nope. There's a cool thing they dug up on Tor.com, jumping back to Amy and Rory for a second. There is a painting by Raphael Sawyer, which was done in 1959, called Consolation. Google this painting. It looks like Amy and Rory.
Yeah. Wow.
And Raphael Sawyer actually... lived in New York City at the time when Amy and Rory were supposedly stuck back there.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, so
there's a great article on Tor.com.
I think it's a plant.
From November 9th, 2012. No, it's an actual painting.
Okay, so
it just happens to look like Amy and Rory.
Let's deal with the 50th anniversary, gang.
50th anniversary. Oh, my goodness, you're right.
Let's see.
Wow. Where is that? Tor.com?
Yeah,
Google
Raphael
Sawyer.
S-O-Y-E-R.
Actually, it looks more like Amy and David Tennant, but...
No, the resemblance is... I'm seeing...
It actually looks more like Amy and Robert Patterson.
oh, please.
Oh, God.
No.
I am so sorry.
No, don't go there. Don't go there.
No, no, no.
That's pretty cool.
All
right.
Okay.
50th anniversary.
50th anniversary.
John, okay. So, all we know is that there was this big, typical Moffat-style build-up for the name of the doctor and all this, and they brought in some grand old Doctor Who tropes, the Great Intelligence, the mentions of the Matrix, and they show us another doctor, played by John Hurt. And he... he's not necessarily an evil doctor, but he's a doctor who did very terrible things. He's not the Valyard, which goes back to Trial of the Time Lord and the theory.
And that was one theory that was flying.
He was the war doctor.
Yeah, that couldn't be. It was totally makes no sense whatsoever, because he would be the doctor because he isn't the total evil guy. He's obviously a guy who's totally penitent. Mm-hmm. He's done something terrible. And what I have been saying for 5 months and on the air, as well as to friends and anybody who won't listen to me.
Random people on the street.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Rested twice for this. Is saying that the 50th anniversary is about the Time Wars. It's about the destruction of the Daleks and Gallifrey. Mm-hmm. And John Hurt is, for some reason, the 8th. And I was always saying this. The 8th Doctor had to split off. It would have to be the 8th Doctor because we don't know about his regeneration. We don't know what happened to him. There's all this open stuff that Big Finish didn't finish. And so he could split off into John Hurt somehow, and John Hurt would become the Doctor who had to do the terrible thing that the Doctor is incapable of doing, but create a doctor who was capable of it. Bingo. I have been saying this for 5 months. Bingo. last week. Mm-hmm. Out comes a minisode called The Night of the Doctor. It's on YouTube. And
all
it's
7 minutes long. So
all
it's
7 minutes long, written by Stephen Moffat, starring Paul McGann, who nailed it.
Yes.
Who nailed it. Oh, my God. Was he great or what?
He was wonderful.
He just got me shouting up and saying, I said he was a great doctor. And then is forced to drink a potion, which will make him regenerate, and we see through the goblet that he turns into John Hurt.
A very young John
Hurt. A very young.
And we should mention the planet he crashes on is where the Sisterhood of Karn is, which goes way back.
Yeah, what is... I don't know that reference. Help me.
From Brain of Morbius.
Yes.
Sacred Fire.
Okay.
It's the same sisterhood. Mm.
Right. Well, I knew that it was an old reference.
Yeah.
Brain of Morbius
established that the Sisterhood of Karn was linked to the Time Lords.
So you see, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And in the Minnesota, they give him basically a potion that will allow him to control his regeneration even more than usual.
So I have I often have Terrence Taylor on this show, and when he and I geek out, it always some point ends up being about Doctor Who, and the whole show is lost at that point, and he will testify. I will make him do so. He's coming over to my house on Saturday to watch. That this is what I have been saying all along. Yeah. And so far, that minisode shows me right. Now, yeah. I've read something else that says something.
Did you see the new episode? The one that came out today?
Yes.
I have not.
Nor have I.
Yeah, it's...
I heard that there was one.
It's 3 minutes, 4 minutes, and...
Is it a Moffat?
Yes.
And
Moffat did write it.
But I don't actually now want to describe it to you, unless...
Well, it's on YouTube, so it's out there. This is not a spoiler.
All right, well, it takes place in...
We described the minisode, might as well describe
it. Unknown time, and a person... we don't see the character... the character's talked at.
He's got a mounted camera.
He's got a mounted camera on his head. He's just woken up. He's actually been dead, we believe, or just injured very badly.
No, he was getting fitted for his uniform. He was part of the Gallifreyan Guard.
Right. Mm. It takes place on Gallifrey, but we don't know that until the end of the episode.
Well, sort of guess that because you can see on the epaulets, we have the Gallifreyan symbols.
Right? Yeah.
And so he's told, okay, you've got to get used to the camera. And by the way, those visions you're seeing, those are just hallucinations. They are in no way visions of the future.
There's no precog. It's just software.
Right.
Don't worry about
it. Yeah. Okay. But he keeps seeing these horrible flashes in front of his face. And so our character is led around and he's told, okay, here we are. This is the safest place on Gallifrey, which is why we know we're on Gallifrey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
And you know, nothing can get in here. But you have to keep a lookout anyway. And if you see something, you know, just it's a bird. But, you know, let's test your software. Take a look out there and say, look at that thing. Let's pretend it's a Dalek. And then, oh, wait, it is a Dalek.
Okay.
It has somehow gotten through this impenetrable
field. So this is yet more confirmation of my theory.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
That was pretty much confirmed by the first trailer they showed anyway, which had tons of people in the Gallifreyan collar things that they introduced in Deadly Assassin and Daleks.
Yeah, now
blowing each other up. So
now you see, and for some reason, I haven't seen that.
Ah, okay.
I've seen the webisode. I've seen a number of trailers.
There was the first trailer that had footage. Some of the footage was of people who very obviously were supposed to be Time Lords, and because they had the silly collars.
Yeah.
And
the Timothy Dalton collars. Yeah.
Oh come on, let's go back to the Deadly Assassin.
Well, I know.
Five doctors had.
Yes, I
know. Like I said, that was in 1977 in the Deadly Assassin. That was when they established those outfits.
I mean,
and we've been stuck with them ever since.
Without those costumes, Rocky Horror would not have been as interesting as it was. But
okay.
They are
so much
top,
for letting my son listen to this.
Oh, pardon me. And by the way, a younger Tim Curry as the Doctor. But anyway.
Yeah. Tim Curry now could probably still do it.
Yeah.
Actually, he could.
Yeah.
Wow.
He's a little.
He'd make a great Belusa, though.
He's getting a little Tom Baker. Yeah. Might make an interesting master. Although, yeah. still,
Anthony,
Derek Jacobi.
No.
Derek Jacobi was the best master ever in all of 3.5 minutes.
I love Sim. Sim is a great actor. He's wonderful. He was not the right person for the master. Anthony Head.
Anthony Head.
Yeah, actually.
Anthony Head. He looks like the previous masters. He's got the stuff for it. You saw him in Merlin.
There was a lot of speculation, actually, when he was in School Reunion.
Right.
Yes, that's right.
And there was some speculation
that he was going to turn out to be the master in that episode, and I was so disappointed he did not.
So was I.
Yeah, so was I.
He would have been awesome.
But on the other hand,
I liked John Sim, but
I especially like
John Sim because I'd only seen him in Life on Mars, and I didn't know he could do that.
I've seen John Sim in many, many things, and I'm aware that he could do that, and he would have been a great Doctor Who villain and all that, but not the master. It's just the wrong role for him. They should have just named him the something else. And by the way, he would make a fascinating Valyard, wouldn't he?
Yes.
Yeah.
But what I still say, with all due respect to Roger Delgado, I honestly think that in those, like, not even 3.5 minutes, Derek Jacobi was the most effective master ever.
Worst master ever? No contest.
The puppet.
No, it wasn't a puppet. That was a guy.
There was a guy under that mask?
Yeah, both times. It was Jeffrey Beavers and Peter Pratt. Mm-hmm. And the Deadly Assassin and Keeper of Trakken. But no, Eric Roberts was...
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Oh, my God.
Of course. You blocked it. He was so bad. You blocked it.
Because, you know, if the choice is... If Eric Roberts is one of your choices for worst whatever, it's got to be him. He wins automatically.
Yeah, actually.
Well, actually, the skull-faced doctor from those episodes, that frightened the hell out of me when I saw
skull-faced master,
yeah. Yeah.
Did anybody else find this ironic that we have the doctor, that we have the master played by Derek Jacobi and the doctor now played by John Hurt, essentially on opposite sides of the lines where they had last played against each other in I, Claudius?
Yeah, we just gotta get.
Oh my God.
We just gotta get Brian Blessed and Patrick Stewart.
I know. Yeah. you've got, and as it is, you've got Magneto and Dr. X on Broadway right now.
Yes, true exactly. Enough.
Professor X.
Professor X, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not Dr. X, it's Dr. Who, it's Professor X.
Yes, okay.
You've got doctors on the brain, I understand.
I have not gotten a name correctly tonight, okay?
If you did get it correctly, you screwed it up later.
So, yes.
That's okay, Tim.
Okay. If you would like to join this conversation, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900 212-209-2900 and if you're not on topic, you'll be cut off the air. Okay, that's now we just had two calls and they just disappeared. We only have two phone lines that come in here, by the way, despite this wonderful professional conference call thing. So, happens is when it rings for a while, the call actually goes into another world. It goes into these other lines that cannot be answered.
It goes into the Satan pit.
Yeah, exactly. That's pretty much it. Yeah. So if you were calling, because I saw people were calling before, call back 212-209-2900. And you guys don't have to hold on to your headphones like that. I'll let you know when a call is coming in.
It's funny you should mention the Satan pit again, because one of the reasons I love Doctor Who is sometimes I just really love the frightening episodes, and that one I found particularly.
Although I have to say, you want fright, Blink will do it, and actually the closing of The Empty Child. Are you my mummy?
Oh, Brian, that was flesh crawling.
One of the things Moffat was always good at was creating good, really good and not gory monsters.
Now you can put on your headphones, by the way, and I will say good morning. You're on the radio.
Good morning, James. Good. The two James on the show tonight or this morning.
Yes. Relevance.
Yes. Anyway, doctor questions. By the way, if the TARDIS did land in Canada, that would be interesting. I could think of a lot of Canadians they would pick up. Maybe William Shatner, Sergeant Preston,
True.
But we do write.
But moving right along, Robert.
Yes. Anyway, a few questions on the Doctor and companions. When a companion ended his run or her run, did they leave them where they found them?
No.
Well, occasionally, but yeah.
Sometimes, yes, sometimes, no.
No, in Jamie's case, I know there were other companions more colorful. I love Jamie just because, being a Scottish nationalist, every time he got...
Half the Doctors are Scottish.
Well, yeah, I know, but he always yelled, "You bloody Sassenach," which is like telling an Englishman where he can stick it.
Yes.
But in any case, yeah, and they left him at Culloden. I didn't know he was supposed to die there.
Yes.
Well, so did most of the people who were at Culloden.
I don't think there weren't that many survivors in
that
battle.
No, there weren't.
Duncan MacLeod, that's about it.
Yeah, that's another story. Yeah. Now, I have a couple of other...
That's the whole point, is that when he goes off there, he's going to his death.
Yeah, well, there's also the other Jamie, too.
I didn't know that. Whose idea, by the way, was it, would somebody tell me, to deposit our fair Gallifreyan Time Lord into October 26th, 1881, please?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Gunfight at the OK Corral.
Oh, yes.
Oh, that was a bad episode.
Yeah.
The Gunfighters, yes. With lots of British actors failing at doing American accents.
Well, who wrote that one?
Oh, I don't remember.
You realized, and I...
It wasn't a good episode, so move on.
Oh, yes. The future Doctor, if the Doctor does get married, do you think he'll have kids?
Doctor is married.
Oh, he is. Does he have kids?
Of course.
Well, he had to have a granddaughter somehow.
No. I just assumed
the entire world, entire galaxy, are the great 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 grandchildren of both River and the Doctor. So.
No, I assumed that his relationship with
under their
with
pseudonyms
Susan,
of Adam and Eve. Right.
I thought his relationship with Susan was, grandfatherly, but not an actual grandfather.
That's a good answer. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not a realistic question.
Oh, all right. May I ask Carol a question, please?
Here.
Carol.
Yeah, why don't you
I'm sorry.
Yes, may I ask you a question, Carol?
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm.
You mentioned that on YouTube you heard a song about a piano, mm-hmm. a piano being moved.
Yes.
Did that song by any chance have a recurrent theme tag at the end of each verse which said, "Then we had a cup of tea"?
Yes, exactly. Yes,
old
that's
English
it.
Old English music hall.
Uh-huh, yes, it's wonderful.
Anyway, congratulations. Oh, yeah, there is one more question. One more question.
Yes.
The episode that was supposed to be the first one, is it true that it was going to run on November 22nd, but in deference to Dallas, they moved it back 24 hours?
No. It's not true at all in any way, shape, or form.
Okay.
Unearthly child.
Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye. What is true, one thing that is true, is that there were two versions of that
episode. The unearthly child moved back in deference to JFK's assassination.
No, the BBC doesn't do things like that. They would have moved it a month, 2 months, or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
They weren't going to change something by a single day. They would just preempt it and start the series at some other
point. And besides, it wasn't like it was, a British politician who died.
Well,
JFK was very popular.
The British do. The JFK was the closest thing we've ever had to royalty.
Yeah.
And the Brits dote on JFK. They dote on the Clintons. They dote on a lot of American stuff in manners that I do not begin to comprehend why.
I don't comprehend why they don't on the royal.
By the way, the
so
fact that
either.
Robert called reminds me that I must promote a very, very, very important event that I failed to promote. The next New York Review of Science Fiction readings that two out of three people have performed at. But Carol isn't a fiction writer.
You have nonfiction, and I will read.
Well, we've actually had nonfiction in the past, but we'd have to find relevance in there. But we're not going to have a reading at the next. Now, December is always our family month. We prefer married couples, and we always have married couples. And as usual, our married couple will be the same as it has been for the last 6 years, and they are Delia Sherman and Ellen Kushner, who are among my favorite married couples. But it's not Delia and Ellen. It's a whole new Delia. Let's put it this way. Live on stage, it will be Delia and Ellen as the narrators. of the new complete audiobook, complete dramatization audiobook of the Riverside Stories by Ellen Kushner, and one of them written by Delia Sherman, with a cast of about 8 people. Neil Gaiman presents, that's a name that wouldn't interest anybody. not that he'll be there. This is the Audible.com branding of this audiobook. Sue Zizza, who is a master of radio drama, there are not that many people left doing it, but she is one of them, and she did Ellen Kushner's The Witches of Lublin, which I broadcast, I think I was the first New York broadcast of it. It was national elsewhere, but New York NPR for some reason did not choose to have it. I did! and I had the cast on, Timothy Jerome and Barbara Rosenblatt, and these are some of the great, great, great audiobook performers and readers. Amy Goldschlager is going to plots, and and I'm doing some audiobook editing and work myself now with John Joseph Adams and Skyboat Media and all that. So this is way cool. Information on this has not gotten out because we are usually the first Tuesday of the month, and for reasons having to do with gallery availability and making sure that Kim and other people were available, we're moving it to Monday, December 2nd. That's like 10 days away, full sound effects, music, actors, Delia and Ellen come to the formerly known Soho Gallery for Digital Art, and I forget what Susanna Perlman is calling it now. It's like Digital Soho, or it's
at 138 Sullivan Street.
It's 138 Sullivan Street. Admission is free. We will hawk you at the door for a donation. There will be victuals. I always thought it was victuals yesterday.
It's victuals.
It's victuals. I never knew that. Yeah. I never knew that. I was editing an audiobook, and the reader said victuals, and the engineer comes in and says, it's victuals. It says here victuals. And they looked it up, and I looked it up. It's victuals. Yeah. I never knew that.
Yeah, yeah, yep. Yeah.
Uh-huh. I never knew that. Uh-huh. Victuals are for cats.
Yep.
who knew? So anyway, that's December 2nd. More information, go to the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings group on Facebook. NYRSF, NYRSF Readings. I don't have it up on my website yet, so don't bother. Ourwolf.com is absolutely current if you're a Time Lord. although, actually, the NYRSF part of it is, except for this, which I have 2 more podcasts to turn out this week before I can even turn to that. I will be making the official mailings and announcements on Monday.
Okay.
Ruby. But I should have mentioned that at the top, and Robert's phone call reminded me.
Yeah.
So that will be quite the event. Hope you'll all be there. Oh. Carol, you have yet to ever make it to one single NYRSF reading.
No, I've been there.
I
have photographic proof.
Do you?
Yeah, right. Picture of me somewhere on the internet.
Cool. Okay, well, if it's on the internet, it must be true.
Yeah. Was it before the gallery?
No, it was at the gallery.
It was at the gallery.
It was a horror reading.
Ah, okay. What, one of the vampire readings? We don't do that many horror readings.
Yes, I guess so.
Because we've done a couple of vampire readings because Margot Adler hosts them. Was Margot the host? You would remember that.
No, I don't recall.
Well, then.
Yeah.
Because we won't really do... I'm not a horror fan.
Hmm.
I don't hate it, but I'm not a fan of it. But vampires, that's Adler's territory, and I will do anything that woman wants. So... my God, we have 12 minutes left.
Where does the time go?
Harmony, of course.
Well, yeah. It seemed like an obvious question to ask.
And it's actually less time than that when you bear in mind that we have to do our outro. And, where is Lister? Burn Baby Burn Clapper should be coming our way at 3 a.m., and I'm not seeing him. We have 15 monitors. The monitor for the room that we are in right now has been taken out. Oh, and I think, just as I say that, I think I see somebody coming down the hall to do the next show. So,
so what do you think is going to be the end of Doctor? The 50th anniversary. You think
it's the Time Wars. It is the Time Wars.
I don't think it's just going to be that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It can't be because there's too many more complications.
Yeah.
But it's going to heavily involve
What I'm hoping it will involve, and I don't think it's going to. And part of the reason why I was hoping this is because what I was hoping John Hurt's Doctor would be, and he isn't. But I was hoping that they would do something that would address what led the Doctor to leave Gallifrey in the first place.
Oh, right. Uh-huh.
The actual inciting...
Have to tell the whole John Hurt story in one episode, do they?
No.
True.
And I'm wondering if they're even
He's
going
done with
They
Merlin.
Also could theoretically tie the Time War into, because it's a Time War, into what it is that led the Doctor to leave Gallifrey in the first place all those years ago when he stole the TARDIS.
I think that you may be right,
first time for everything.
I read a spoiler somewhere that said something about a lot of the episode taking place with David Tennant and Matt Smith in Victorian England.
Okay.
Why would that be if we're dealing with the Time Wars?
Because of the webisode, he's in a museum. Matt Smith is in a museum and they see paintings being broken out of, and maybe they were right. actual.
Oh, yeah, I did see that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the bit they aired during Children in Need.
Well,
yeah, that was
where he grabs the fez.
So perhaps those paintings were paintings from the 1800s. That's my only guess.
Yeah, that's a reasonable guess, though.
I'll be honest with you. I think when we opened it, we were talking about the fact that this is going to be shown simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is that there are only two other things.
And we should mention, by the way, rebroadcast.
Rebroadcast.
Well, after that.
And right. it's
Here's Lister,
time slot,
but Lister is a Red Dwarf character, so...
Right.
Yes.
Right. Hello. Well, the thing is...
His name is Lister. Why can't I tell you?
The thing is that there are only two other things that have ever gotten this type of transmission before. That's the Academy Awards and the Super Bowl. So this makes it...
No, the World Cup.
Well...
World Series. No, they don't get...
World Cup.
World Cup, absolutely, she's right.
That's true. In any event...
And God knows, at this radio station, we have so many soccer fans. Oh, my God.
Yes, a lot of soccer or football fans, if you'd prefer. But the point is this. The last time you had a worldwide event that was simultaneously being broadcast all throughout the world at exactly the same moment, I had 10 bucks riding on the Niners. I don't want to lose money anymore, so I'm going to have to back away from this one.
For predictions. Well, actually, one of the reasons I love Doctor Who is because you don't really know what's going to happen next. You know, you can kind of guess, but it goes everywhere. It goes to every time. Mm-hmm. It goes to every place. So I don't want to guess because I want to be excited and see something as if new. So if I think about it too much, I might actually come to some sort of logical conclusion, like, oh, no, and there it is.
Yeah.
I'd rather not.
And we haven't discussed the Peter Capaldi choice. I like so many other people, and disappointed that it wasn't a woman or a black woman or for a while I was going for Adrian Lester, although it was John Ordover who came up with the answer for Adrian Lester.
Mm.
Adrian Lester as Simon Templar.
Ooh.
The two aren't mutually exclusive.
Well, yeah.
He can play Simon Templar, and he can also play the... I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is playing Sherlock Holmes and Iron Man at the same time.
But Adrian Lester
as Simon Templar, as the saint, just perfect. Yes. Adrian Lester is, the among other things, the lead in Hustle, which is a British show about con artists.
But I first knew him as an American. I thought he was American in Primary Colors.
That's right.
That's the first thing I saw him in, Primary Colors. And I was only after that did I see Hustle, and I was utterly convinced that he was American in that. So he can pull it off, but he can do the con. Boy, can he do the con! So
the person I wanted to see as the Doctor was Lenny Henry, but
that would have been nice.
Yeah. Although I wonder, you know, we know Lenny Henry from a few years ago. What is he like now?
But I was really happy with the choice of Capaldi a number of reasons, not the least of which was the fact was
he's a classic style doctor.
That and also specifically his performance in the Torchwood miniseries. Children
that
of
was
Earth.
It.
Yeah,
that
wonderful.
Was it.
He
I mean,
was the heart and soul of that story.
Absolutely.
My God, the best thing in Children of Earth, the most heart wrenching. Thing yeah, is that yeah. character. He starts out as a buffoon, and he ends.
He's not even a buffoon. He's just
he's a bureaucrat.
He's the world's most ordinary person. You know, he's the classic bland government mid-level bureaucrat who suddenly finds himself in a position where he has to make life or death decisions about the entire frickin' planet. You know, well, and that's devastating.
He was devastated.
You know, that is the correct word. You know what, gang? We are totally out of time, as it were. I am playing,
ironic. For
I'm not playing my. Drive. We didn't play our proper intro music, so we're not playing our outro music. I'm going to play a song. I am playing, if you put on your headphones, in the background, a song by the Eagles.
Eagles.
Yes, the Eagles.
How fitting. Yes.
It's called Journey of the Sorcerer. Thank you very much. I'll put it up for a moment so you can hear it.
And appropriate.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
which is
that,
known to geeks the world over as the theme music
for years.
The Hitchhiker's Guide
for
to the Galaxy.
Years, I never knew that was the Bleeping Eagle.
Really?
I didn't know. I didn't know. It's like one time I'm listening
to
an Eagles
album. You can't pronounce
Bills.
You didn't know about the Eagles.
And that comes on, and I'm going, wait a minute, wait. What's Douglas Adams doing on my
Eagles album
here? At any rate, Keith DeCandido, your website, how people find you, your latest books.
You can find me at decandido.net. That's links to my Facebook page, my blog, the podcasts I do, and ordering links for my recent books and stuff. My next book is going to be Griffin Precinct, which is the latest book in my fantasy police procedural. Oh. And next May is a Star Trek book called The Klingon Art of War, which is going to be a big coffee table book.
Oh, good God.
About how to live your life as a proper Klingon warrior. Awesome. It's my first self-help book.
Jim Ryan. James Ryan.
Yes. Well, my blog is resident where my first novel is at www.raginggale.wordpress.com, and the book that I last shared with everybody, Red Jenny and the Pirates of Buffalo, is www.redjennybuffalo.wordpress.
A word of advice, never say www. Don't need it. Try any web address in the world. Drop the www.
Well, I'm sorry. I'm old-fashioned.
It just gets in the way. By the way, Douglas Adams told me treble you dot this or that. Yeah. And years later, when Starship Titanic was out and I did another interview with him, I mentioned, so it's at treble you whatever. He says, treble you? What's that? I said, www. I got that from you. He said, oh, that's brilliant. I'm going to use that. So I got it from him.
All right.
Carol Pinchevsky.
Carol Pinchevsky. CarolPinchevsky.com. Pin like the needle, chef like the cook, sky like the thing above you.com.
Oh, that's nice.
And you can find my articles, most but not all of my articles there.
Yes, a lot about video games, lot about personal tech.
Yeah,
and
geek culture in general.
And geek culture, and if you're an editor, go there. She's a freelancer. Enough said. Me, I will be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. Not an absolute, but a great likelihood that my guest will be the director of the Museum of Science Fiction.
Ooh.
Greg Vigiano.
Very nice.
I already did an interview with him, but he'll be in New York for Thanksgiving.
That is a great job.
Okay. Yeah. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. Coming your way over these airwaves shortly. Thank you so much. And, oh yes, next week everybody will be, well, guest talking about what we got right and wrong about Saturday. In the meantime, as I said on a different show, be seeing you. Take care.
Bye.
Good morning.
Thanks.
Push the button, again. Frank.
last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary. And you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the bitch. Red part of the blue spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk my people, the people all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my writing, is writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too. Burn the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. To wake up to the lies, the pigs make up imperialistic swines that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist, cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I rag it and snag it and drag it and rip it to shreds, cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy, so just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn. Let's find the people who hate this. These are the places we'll hit.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania, Brixton, Belfast, and forget Korea, Beirut, and forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico. Talk about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all. And Nicaragua, East and South Central, LA, California, IA, Miami. Do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag. That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home of the brave. The free, boom, this is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment, so why wanna score?
back to the American flag and burn.
Tonight, single list alive right here at WBAI. 5 minutes after three, 5 minutes after the hour, 3 o'clock right here. Flag burning time, 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. 99 Cinco. We're gonna do this until 5 o'clock. Background briefing kicks in at 5 o'clock. Amy Goodman at 8 o'clock. Democracy Now More Than Ever. This is Doctor Who. The genius, I run.
But was he for the medical sector? To be me, got together on the jump and play. Shake my medical sector each and every day. We you can follow, keep the move around and play. You know, I do what they say.
Massachusetts, this is for you. Burn, baby, burn. 9 minutes after 3 o'clock. 9 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Lista.
Tomorrow. natural. We uphold your guidance. Whoa. You speak in parables, but fighting for your devilish dreams. Reciting words to deceive. Only so you need. Speak of the devil and they will appear. Speak on the truth and let your words be clear so you hear. Declare the proof and pray you just speak to defeat all those who seek to rule with fire and fear. Those who seek to rule with fire and fear.
When it comes to this type of music, the best you get right here on Midnight Ravers, Apte Selassie, yo, Labrish, Yalissa Mick, 99 single list alive right here, Burn Baby Burn, the only flag burning show where we burn the imperialist red, white and blue all glory with no apology. To ashes before 5 o'clock, we're background briefing kicks in, y'all. We don't force you to bow down to no Selassie the first. Oh, how they justify proof they we make proletariat revolution, y'all.
Meditate on the crimes that lie in plain sight. Hear the earth moving, cry out. Don't blind yourself to the truth. Don't claim you're not a part of it. You can't just shut your eyes to the world you're living in. Remember the bird starts with a spark to spread some light. Now these words will ignite fires to bless the chosen.